Welcome to Dreamland's 2020 year-end special. It's presented in full for both subscribers and non-subscribers without commercial breaks. So non-subscribers, it's time. Go to unknowncountry.com and join us. Now, let's get started. Twenty is finally ending and 2021 is beginning. Welcome to Dreamland. Welcome to our year-end special. As we cross the year between 2020, goodbye, thank you, do not return, and 2021, may you be less interesting than 2020 was. We have five great guests. Leslie Keene, the New York Times reporter who has revolutionized the world with her reporting on the UAP phenomenon. We're going to have the next Deep Prasad, who had a remarkable close encounter experience. What's so special is that he is also one of the leading artificial intelligence scientists on planet Earth. We will have Mitch Horowitz talking about the future of the soul and how things are changing. Jeff Kripal on the flip. What is happening in our world that people are beginning to see things in such a new way? Lee Spiegel on his remarkable life and career. He was the one who began a lot of the official work that's been done on this with the UN conference on UFOs that was held back in 1979, that long ago. Incredible material. He's going to tell us also about some forgotten UFO encounters. There was a time when the military was allowed to talk about this, but we've forgotten. We have forgotten so much. Lee's going to remind us of some of these extraordinary things. And one of the producers of the blockbuster phenomenon, along with James Fox and Mark Barish, he's going to give us some new insights into the film and what was behind it all. So it's going to be an incredible show. And in addition, between each episode, I'm going to read from my new book, Jesus, A New Vision, which is now available for pre-order on Amazon.com as a Kindle and will soon be available as an audiobook, a hardcover, and a paperback. So let's get started with this year-end show. First up, Leslie Keene. As you know, that byline appears every so often in the New York Times, along with Ralph Blumenthal and others, when they have a new UFO story. We used to call them UFO stories, but now we call them UAP stories. Not because, for a reason actually, UFO means unidentified flying object, but that's not what they are. They are UAPs, unidentified aerial phenomena. But before we explore more deeply into what is going to happen, what Leslie imagines may happen in regard to that phenomena in the future, we're going to go to in another direction to a remarkable book that she wrote a few years ago called Surviving Death. She is also the author of UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. And so we have here, in my opinion, one of the most important influences on this culture who is now working, Leslie Keene. Welcome to Dreamland's year-end special.
Thanks, Whitley. That's quite an introduction, but yeah, I hope I can live up to that in the future, but I greatly appreciate being on your show. It's always so good to talk to you.
A journalist investigates evidence for an afterlife. Surviving Death is also a Netflix documentary, and it's dynamite. Fabulous stuff. You do go to Netflix and watch the, it's six episodes, I believe. Is that right, Leslie?
Yeah, it's a documentary series based on my book, Surviving Death, and it's premiering on Netflix on January 6th. There is a trailer that people can go and watch before that. If you just go to Netflix.com/Surviving Death, and there is a trailer up there. And, yeah, we're really excited about it. It took about 2 years to make this series, and I was a consulting producer working with a fabulous film company in New York here that I've worked with on other projects on these sorts of topics. And the whole thing was a Netflix original, so we're really excited about it coming out in early January.
I should say, well, I'm excited about it too. It's powerful stuff, and I haven't seen the whole thing, but it is obviously a high level of production skill here, and the journey, the surviving death journey. Where did this start for you, Leslie? Because the book is marvelous. It is so empowering because the stories in it are so believable. I mean, you're a very fine reporter, and it shows. Tell us a little bit about.
Thank you,
Whitley. Yeah, oh, you're welcome. Tell us a little bit about why you became interested in this in the first place.
Well, you know, I think, as you are well aware, there's a connection between UFOs and these issues around consciousness and the afterlife and all of this. And the whole time I was reporting on UFOs, which was really, you know, 10 years before my book, and then another 10, but even, let's say before my book came out, so those first 10 years, I was very interested in this topic, Whitley, and I'd always kind of poked around in it, especially in cases of reincarnation where very young children would remember past lives. And then they were verified, the memories were verified as accurate. I was just stunned by the evidence and data that had been collected on cases like that. As a journalist, you know, it was just very concrete, those cases. That's sort of what drew me into this. And then after my UFO book came out and it did very well, my publisher invited me to do another book. And this just seemed like the absolute natural topic for me because I'd had an interest in it. And this would, doing the book gave me an opportunity to research it in the way that I felt inspired to do that and bring the information forward. And it really turned out to be a very personal journey for me because when I began the book, I didn't know that much about the topic. Whereas when I did my UFO book, I had been studying and investigating and reporting on UFOs for 10 years. So it was kind of more like a culmination. But this book was more like a beginning into something that I explored and learned about as I went along. And I had my own personal experiences that went into the book as well, which I never expected would ever happen. So it's a very different kind of book from UFOs, but it's still journalism. I was very careful, and I appreciate that you said that because I was very careful to keep it objective, and it's a journalistic exploration. And in my mind, it's just as journalistic as anything else I've done. But I did describe some of my own personal experiences, and I acknowledge that these are not, these can't be verified by anybody or, you know, some of them. But that's okay. I felt I had to include them, and they're interesting. And I think people trust me, so I thought it was okay to do that. So that's the story. I mean, I've always had an interest in this. And the Netflix series, what's really interesting about it, I think it's sort of different than my book in that it focuses more on the journeys of people who are grappling with this, as people who have lost loved ones and they go see a medium, or people who have had communications from the afterlife, or children who remember past lives. It's not as hardcore evidential as my book is, but it's very character-driven. That's how the filmmakers describe it. And so they took my book, and then they created something based on the book, which was unique to their vision of surviving death, of the whole question of an afterlife. So that's really what I have to say about it. I think that people, if people like the Netflix show, they're going to learn more if they get my book. And if they get my book, they're going to learn more if they watch Netflix, because they don't, they only overlap somewhat. Just the basic ideas are the same.
Well, one of the first story in your book is one of the most arresting stories of actually not afterlife, but reincarnation, which of course is related, the James Leninger story. And I interviewed his parents on Dreamland years ago. But the way you report on the story makes it just startlingly convincing. Could you tell us a little bit about that, about what happened, why James Leninger's story is so exceptional?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, exceptional partly because he was so young when these memories occurred. He was barely talking. And, I mean, we could spend, you know, I don't want to take up a whole interview giving you all the details about that case, but it was just this, what's so profound about it is that he had these very specific memories that would just come out at different times, and they had to do with him being a World War II pilot in a previous life. He had continuous nightmares about crashing in a plane into the water. He knew that, and then he would bring forward certain names. He knew the name of the aircraft carrier that he flew off of. He knew the name of his best friend. He knew his own name in the previous life. And there were, he was drawing all these photographs. I mean, drawing all these pictures when he was, you know, three of the crashes. His father was determined to prove that this was not a past life. So his father became kind of obsessed with doing a lot of research into it. And everything, when James would say something else, he was going to all these reunions with people who had been on the aircraft carrier, which was the Natoma Bay that James had pointed to in a book one day and said, that's where my plane went down. Now, this was a kid who hadn't been exposed to any of this stuff. And he knew about how World War II airplanes worked. He knew how to identify the different types of planes. I mean, he had a lot of knowledge. And then he had these nightmares. Then he had these memories. So it was a whole, there's just so much detail that he was able to bring forward until eventually his father went to these reunions with the veterans, and by piecing everything together was able to find the person who James was in that previous life. And it matched everything James had said about this person. And they actually found his sister, the previous person's sister, who was in her 80s. And James, little James, actually met her when he was about five. And she completely connected with him. And she was convinced that he was indeed the reincarnation of her brother, because he was able to tell her things about their childhood that nobody ever knew except her. So anyway, to get more detail about it, you can read my book. It's absolutely chilling. It gives me goosebumps even to talk about it right now, Whitley. It's just such a chilling
thing. Yeah, it's one of the most amazing. It's one of the most amazing stories of any kind ever told. And
what's interesting, yeah, I think you're right. In Surviving Death in the Netflix show, we actually went back and visited with James, who's now 21. So we were able to have him talk to us about how this has affected his life and what he still remembers and doesn't remember. And we did an interview with his parents. And so it was really fascinating to go back and meet him as an adult. And he has done very few interviews. He's quite shy about it, but he was absolutely riveting in this. So that's something that people will be able to see who are interested in this case.
Yeah, I would love to interview him myself, but so far he is shy about interviews. Let me put it that way. In any case, and I don't blame him. I mean, he's trying to live a life now, and it's not that life. It's
exactly.
A new life. So I haven't really pressed them about that. And, because if he wants to interview at some point in his life, people will start to hear from him. And I'm glad you got him on the show though, because it's going to be fascinating to see. He is, one thing that you didn't mention was the name of the aircraft carrier was so obscure. It wasn't like one of the great aircraft carriers of World War II. His father had to delve into Defense Department records to even find that it had existed.
Right. It wasn't an obvious one. It's true. He scrolled through. I think he went through the Internet and he went pages and pages and pages on Google.
Yes.
Before anything came up about it.
Right.
You know, pages and pages and pages. It's not like it jumped right out of him at all. And the same, you know, there was also a specific type of airplane that James said he flew, which was called a Corsair. You know, who knows what that is now? And it was this very sophisticated World War II airplane, and such an interesting story.
Yeah.
Really, because James insisted he flew that plane, and the records of his previous personality's death, his name was also James Houston Jr., all indicated that he was flying, I think it was an F-17, some other kind of plane, and he clearly was flying some other kind of plane when he died. And so so his dad was really happy because he said, okay, he didn't get that one right. You know, maybe this isn't a past life. Well, then when they met James Houston's sister, who was in her 80s, Annie, who was the sister of the previous person, she sent them all these photographs of her brother. And there he was in one of those photographs standing next to a plane that was a Corsair, the exact plane that James had said he had flown, that none of the people researching the case could verify. And at that moment, they verified it. And he was right. He'd been right all along about that plane. Apparently, Houston flew it a lot because it was a very special plane. And it was the kind of thing you would imagine being really important to him because he was chosen to fly this plane, especially trained for it. And so in the moment he died, he was just driving a kind of a run-of-the-mill airplane that nobody would really think anything about. But this special one is the one that his little James Leininger remembered, and it all sort of made sense. Yeah, it's just so fascinating.
I had an uncle who flew Corsairs in the Pacific War. He considered it the best airplane in the sky. And I also had another uncle who flew Mustangs in Germany, and he considered that the best airplane in the sky. So who knows?
Oh, yeah. Well,
but in any case,
the Corsairs were right up there. They were pretty high tech at the time.
Oh, yeah. They were. They were very fast and capable. But now let's go on a little bit. Where are you now in terms of your thoughts about afterlife communication? Because before we went on the air, we're recording this on December the 11th, and the following things have happened in my life. Yesterday I discovered, this is December the 10th, I'm talking about, that the guest I was going to have on Dreamland today had died of COVID. And so I had to really scramble. This morning I went on a podcast and I was talking about the afterlife revolution, and Anne was present, as she always is in these cases, and probably is right now, I would think, in the sense that not that she's not always present, but in the sense that when my attention is directed in this direction, I can perceive her presence and sometimes even communicate with her. Then I found a show from the distant past from 2003 that ran on Dreamland the week of the 11th, with Betty Kovacs, who has lost most of her family in a series of car accidents and created a foundation and was one of the first people to really take the measure of afterlife communication. So all of that happened, and now here we are talking about afterlife communication. So I have to ask you where you are now with this material. Would you ever do another book? Have you taken it any farther? Or did you do your reporting on this and now moved on?
Well, I certainly haven't moved on, Whitley, because I'm fascinated by it, and I feel I have a lot more that I want to learn, a lot more that I want to read about it. So it's kind of an ongoing process for me of engagement with this stuff. And, I don't have in mind another book, but that doesn't mean there's a lot more really interesting material. There is a lot more interesting material than what I was able to cover in my book, that's for sure. And so I'm just kind of on this journey still with it. And I'm particularly interested in physical mediumship. It's just for some reason, because I've been involved with this physical medium and studied him for 5 years. And I believe you interviewed him, or you're going to interview him.
Yes, he'll be on Dreamland next month.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in January. His name is Stuart Alexander, folks.
Right. Excellent human being, excellent medium. And, you know, I have all these books on my bookshelf that I haven't had time to read. A lot of them are, you know, ancient, really old books from the early 1900s or late 1800s that are about other physical mediums. So for me, Whitley, it's just an ongoing journey, and I know I have a lot to learn, and it's very mysterious, and I love things that are mysterious. And also the question of how this connects with the UFO phenomenon, which is something you've explored, is also something I'm exploring, and so it never ends. I never move on from these things.
I think the key, one of the great keys to understanding the UFO phenomenon is its connection, or I should say now the UAP phenomenon, since I made that big speech at the beginning of the show.
Hard to get away from UFO, though.
Yeah, it is. It is.
But in fact, we always use it in the New York Times. We use it. They have the people who write the headlines in the New York Times want to use that because nobody knows what UAP is. It's not going to attract attention.
Right.
So they always use that term in the New York Times, if that means anything.
Well, I was talking to Chris Mellon about it the other day, we were wondering if people would ever get to UAP because it's more ambiguous and the public has trouble with ambiguity, God knows.
I know, so. But it is, I agree with you, it's a more appropriate term.
Right. Not our public, not you guys, folks. I know you can understand the difference between UAP and UFO. It meant immediately. I have enormous respect for my own audience, who are deeply, most of them very deeply into this and very thoughtful about it. But let's excavate a little bit more about the connection between the phenomenon and the dead, because speaking of Chris Mellon, that brings up TTSA, and they have material viewpoint. They're looking for the materials and the way things work and that sort of thing, much more than they are the spiritual side of it. And I've wondered, is it possible to do just that, or do the two things intersect? Do you have to have the spiritual side, that is to say, the relationship, understanding the relationship between the visitors and our dead and us, in order to make any headway on the material side? Because you and I both know, and we both know we probably can't talk about it too much, but that they haven't made the kind of progress with the materials that you would think they had made in the 70 years since we have had some of this material.
Right, because it's not definitive enough. That's the issue. I mean, I think, Whitley, you can do both on parallel tracks, because certainly I am my colleague Ralph Blumenthal and I are continuously focused every day on digging for possible stories for the New York Times on the UAP or UFO, whatever you want to call it. I mean, we want to keep our reporting going because it has made such an impact. And those stories, of course, don't go anywhere near the kind of thing we're talking about. But yet they're extremely important. They deal with the physical reality of this thing in the sky, you know. But that's where they have to stay. And that's, it's opening a lot of doors, and it's really productive to do those stories. That doesn't mean that I'm also not engaged with it in other ways. They're just a little bit more private, you know, and I mean, pretty much I've kept my interest in the issue of consciousness after death separate from my approach to the UFO issue. And I worked on them both as separate things. And I pretty much do that publicly. But it doesn't mean that I'm not trying in my own way to connect them in some way. It's just not something you put in the New York Times, you know?
No, you don't.
So I think they can all happen at once. And I think that's the way it has to be. We all have to work on all these different levels at once in order to move the issue forward. That's my sense of it.
Well, for example, the things that are happening now recently, James Fox and Mark Barish produced The Phenomenon, and a hugely important documentary about the UFO phenomenon. And they interviewed on Dreamland, but the show just barely touches on the close encounter experience, just the aerial school story and nothing else. And I recently had a discussion with TTSA, with all five of the members, not directly. I was directly discussing it with three of them. But they decided they did not want to come on Dreamland, not now, because they are struggling to make the phenomenon more publicly acceptable. And they feared that if they were connected to the close encounter people, that when they did show up on the general media, they might have trouble, because this might be brought up. And for example,
doesn't really make sense. Anyway.
No, it doesn't make sense to me either. But another example is recently Joe Rogan discussed me on his show with Dennis McKenna and said, "No, I'd never have him on. He's too far out." And then George Knapp was on Joe Rogan and defended me, very sweetly of him, very nice of him to do it. But there's a huge gulf here, because the elephant in the room is the abduction phenomenon. You can't deal with this without that, without dealing with that.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, if we deal, like, what would happen to you if you tried to deal with the abduction phenomenon in the New York Times in any way whatsoever?
I know, they wouldn't accept it. The editors would never publish it. That's why I think we have to move towards it as best we can. And, you know, I agree with you, that's the elephant in the room, Whitley. I'm just not, you know, the particular role that I play in all of this does not allow me to focus on that. But that doesn't mean I wouldn't do an interview with you. I mean, I think the TTSA people did an interview with you and you discussed their work. That doesn't mean that they're somehow supporting or even commenting on the abduction phenomena. They wouldn't even have to talk about it. But anyway.
Well, yeah, I know, but they're scared.
You know, I'm very comfortable acknowledging it and talking to people like you. I just obviously can't bring it into the New York Times, but believe me, I would like to. And I'm hoping that maybe there'll be some projects next year. I have a couple of projects lined up that are really exciting that I cannot talk about now, because that when things are at an early stage, you just can't. But I think you and I have discussed one of them a little bit, and I mean, just can't say anything about it now, but I'm hoping that some of the work I do will gradually be able to bring people like you into it, and you would be the most important person I could imagine bringing into any coverage of this.
Well, so, I certainly hope so.
I'm really interested in doing that. I just have to be in a position where I can make it happen in a way that, you know, works and that keeps my process going my relationship to media and everything else. And so I agree with everything you're saying about it. But, you know, it's funny because the TTSA people on their show Unidentified, which is on History Channel, they did a whole episode on Close Encounters.
Right. I know that, but they don't want to interview with me. I pointed that out to them.
Yeah.
And I think
I don't quite understand it, but.
Well, they may be a little scared of me, and, you know, because one of the problems has always been that the visitors are here. I mean, they're involved, and I think that some of the people in the government end of it might be nervous about the visitors seeing them too clearly, seeing what they're doing or something. I just don't know. I couldn't figure it out, frankly.
I don't mean to be any disrespect to them. It's just puzzling, that's all.
Yeah, it's puzzling to me, too.
They probably have their reasons for making the choices they make.
And, I'm sure they do. They're good people. Hal Putoff has been a dear friend for years, and I know he's also a dear friend of yours.
He is, indeed.
He is probably the most knowledgeable person in TTSA because he's been at it for so long, and he's been... Gosh, I mean, he knows where all the bodies are buried almost.
I know. If only it wasn't classified, Whitley.
Well,
how many times I've approached Hal with questions, and I always bump up against that. That's the trouble. I just want people to know the reason that Ralph and I cannot do more with stories about crash retrievals and other things that we want to report on is because things are classified, and we always get to a certain point, and yet we can't go any further because
yes.
of everything being classified. And Hal, of course, is very careful, as is anyone with clearances, about they just won't reveal anything that is classified, and they can't. So I just can't, you know, that reinforces to me what you're saying, that he really knows a lot.
Oh, that was an enormous amount.
Because there's been so many times over the year where we say, well, I can't say anything more about that. Well, I can't say more about that. It doesn't mean he doesn't know. He just can't say because of the, you know, the regulations that govern his security clearances. And it's so
right.
frustrating because so much more is classified than should be classified. And he would even agree with that.
Oh, yeah.
He can't reveal it. Yeah.
Well, it's
really
it's,
frustrating.
It's very frustrating because I want to get on to another subject now, and it's a sort of a segue, but it has to do with classification and with your work on the Times. I've noticed something. You started your first story in the Times appeared in 2017, as I recall. Is that correct? Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Late December.
Well, after that, QAnon. Its trajectory began to increase and kept increasing. And the more stories, the more the public realized that there was something huge hidden, the more that exploitative level gained traction. I'm not a sociologist, so I can't say that there's a definite connection, but I sense there might be, that the public feels, knowing that this is all there and that it's hidden, they feel, in a sense, cut off from reality. And that is a wedge a crack that QAnon went through in order to exploit them further. And
right.
I think we're reaching the point where the classification system itself is corroding our society, and we really have to do something about it, or public distrust will destroy this republic.
It's a really interesting point. Plus, it allows people like QAnon to think, well, if that's covered up, then this is covered up also.
Right.
You know, it just gives them more of a rationale to believe in all these other things that they think, well, the government's probably hiding this as well. And so it just spins out of control.
It spins out of control. And I think we're very close to spinning out of control. And I think that you're in a position where it must be maddening for you and Ralph, I have to say. In fact, I know it is because you've consulted me from time to time on your work. And, because we're kind of in a race. If this doesn't come into focus, I think the government is going to lose the public trust pretty much completely over the next few years. That's my sense.
Well, I do think having a new administration is going to help a lot with just trust in general and just, you know, getting things back to a sane kind of a sane governing body here, but in terms of the UFO issue, you know, I don't expect anything to change particularly, but you just don't know.
Well, you know,
I mean, an example being this photograph that Tim McMillan wrote about of the triangle that hasn't been released. You know, your listeners probably know about that. And he issued a artist rendition of it, and people described it who have witnessed this photograph. But it's classified, and there is no legitimate reason, I mean, that I can think of for it to be classified. And people, sources I have who are themselves restricted, who may have seen it, who understand the necessity to keep certain things classified, agree that this photograph with nothing on it that would reveal anything to our adversaries that we have to worry about, it's being kept classified. And why is that? There's no need for that. And everybody goes crazy trying to get their hands on it, you know? When
yeah.
It could just be declassified and released. Why not?
Well, classification makes it seem important. You think, oh, well, it must be important if it's secret. When often classification is just something that's in the way. And,
it's just sort of automatic. They just do it. It's just done, without
right.
a lot of thought.
Right, exactly.
I mean, they tend to err on the side of classifying too much and classifying too little.
Right.
And, I understand that there's a need for national security concerns with regards to this issue, and certain things have to be kept private, but a photograph of a triangle in the sky, you just have to wonder, why should that be kept from human beings? Why don't we all have a right to see that?
Well, I wonder, because one of the things that... There's a meme out there that we have a triangular craft, that we fly one, and we may. However, I can assure you, I don't think it's called the TRB-3 or whatever it was, because I made that up. It appears first, as far as I know, in my book, The Grays. And yet, you look up TRB-3 on Google, you'll find all kinds of stories about how it works and blah, blah, and blah. And, so you just have to wonder where this is all going. Leslie Keene, we have come to the end of our time together in the annual special, folks. There will be more from Leslie Keene, Ralph Blumenthal, and the New York Times in the future, I hope. But in the meantime, go and do watch the Netflix documentary, which starts again on the 11th of January. Is that correct?
The 6th of January,
The 6th of January, and enjoy it, and enjoy Leslie's book. Surviving Death is such a fine, fine work of, I would almost say, not only of reporting, but almost of scholarship. It's so well done.
Well,
and
thank you, Whitley.
The UFOs, generals, pilots, and government officials go on the record is quite frankly a classic. So go out and get them and enjoy them. And let's hope we see that wonderful Leslie Keene byline in the Times. Something very exciting in 2021.
You will. We're not giving up. I'll tell you that.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on, Whitley.
My new book, Jesus, A New Vision, is available for pre-order in Kindle form right now on Amazon.com. It will be available as an Audible audiobook, as a hardcover and a paperback later on in the month. I would like to begin by reading from the introduction. I'm going to read little two-minute pieces from the book over the course of the show. There are many stories of Jesus, that he was God incarnate, that he was a man with a special relationship to God, that he was a teacher, a revolutionary, even that he never existed at all. But none of them come close to the real story, which is due to advancing knowledge of many different kinds just now emerging. There is no story, not of any life, that equals its power, its capacity to amaze, its surpassing strangeness, or its importance. In this book, I propose to tell not only the story of a truly extraordinary life, but also of its almost unknown aftermath. Because of the story of Jesus, a great and ancient civilization was destroyed and replaced by something new. But why? How did it happen that an obscure carpenter from an obscure corner of a great empire somehow caused this most powerful of all human events? what unfolded from the birth of Jesus to the final collapse of the Roman Empire was the greatest upheaval the world has ever known. A whole civilization with its beliefs, its gods, its temples, and its books was overturned and replaced by a new one. During this process, Jesus the teacher disappeared into Christ the God, and it is a great part of my objective here to rediscover the teacher so that we can once again walk the path of life that he laid out. I will not say that Christianity is a failure. Like all great human enterprises, it has been a force for both good and evil in the world. Hidden deep beneath Christian doctrine, there is another Jesus and another vision. It is this vision that I hope to bring to the surface. We're going to be talking next to Deep Prasad. Deep is highly respected in the area of artificial intelligence. His company that he founded at the age of 25 or 24, Reactive Q, is leading in certain areas of artificial intelligence that are truly remarkable, as you'll hear in the interview. But Deep has had an extraordinary experience with the visitors. We'll certainly be talking about that too. Deep, welcome to Dreamland.
Thank you so much, Whitley, for having me here. I'm extremely excited to talk to you.
Well, good. I'm glad because you talk to a lot of people. You do a lot of interviews. You are very active on Twitter. Can you tell us first what your company does, what Reactive does?
Yeah, so Reactive Q works on materials discovery and accelerating the materials discovery process. Essentially, currently, the way that we discover new materials, you know, new semiconductors, new photovoltaic cells, new alloys for, let's say, spaceships, all of these things are discovered through trial and error and human intuition. We're trying to replace that by training artificial intelligence agents that run on quantum computers and quantum simulators. And we use those, let's say, agents to solve the underlying many-body Schrodinger equations and very important quantum mechanical equations used to predict materials before you have to go and build them. So imagine having a system that can find the next generation of semiconductors far faster and better than any human scientist can. That's what we work on.
Now, we're going to get back to that in just a minute because it's a huge part of why I've invited you to this year-end special. But first, let's just briefly, why don't you recount what happened to you that caused you to take an interest in, of all things, the field of close encounters?
Certainly. So, for a bit of context, you know, I was somewhat dabbling in the UAP UFO field around 2018 November. That's when my interest really started, near the end of October, early November. And 3 or 4 months later, around February 1st, exactly February 1st, actually, of 2019, I ended up having what we would call a close encounter as well. So this was in the morning. This was while I was working, and I found myself completely paralyzed. And by the way, I had, just for, you know, context for viewers, you know, I had taken no substances, nothing. I had enough sleep. You know, I don't have any mental illness that could explain away any of this. And so I suddenly found myself totally paralyzed. And eventually, you know, within seconds, I see these three humanoid beings in front of me. They were very small with absolutely humongous heads, fully perfect white suits, no seams, nothing. And these sort of golden symbols in the center of their suits that were just constantly changing. And, you know, they quickly started showing these hieroglyphs that were, let's say, imagine, like, the way that I like to describe it is imagine seeing 3D subtitles in real life, and they're just sort of flipping. So it was as if, you know, you have this horizontal row of letters and paragraphs, but they were hieroglyphs or some sort of, you know, hieroglyphic language. I'm not sure which one. And they just kept flipping, like flip, flip, flip. I had no idea what they meant, except there was one word, an English word, that was sandwiched between these sentences and paragraphs. And I saw that about three or four times during this experience. And that word or acronym was DNA. And so, you know, the entire encounter, at first, I was absolutely terrified. I had never been so scared in my life. I often like to explain to people that, you know, it's almost as if there's, so you might be familiar with epigenetics. It's almost as if my brain and body and my subconscious knew before my conscious mind could even register the fear and danger I was in. You know, it's like my, you know, my body immediately kicked in. Like it knew that this was not normal, and that it's as if like there was a certain level of fear that we've been trained to have in these kinds of experiences. Very hard to explain, but yeah. And so after this sort of, experience, it completely left me confused. It left me, let's say, spiritual. I had absolutely no interest in the world of spirituality or any belief systems around that. And frankly, overnight, you know, these things changed. And I wanted to look for answers. So I did some digging investigation, and I found this private space conference that was being held by the guys who ran the Pentagon UAP program. Lou Elizondo and Hal Putoff were the host there. It was held in Huntsville, Alabama, at the SCU conference. And so I immediately, you know, applied. I got accepted and booked a ticket for the next month and flew there to start investigating the sort of key researchers in the field and just understand more about UAPs and UFOs. And, you know, since then, I've just taken a deep, very deep interest in this entire subject.
Yeah, Hal is an interesting guy. I've known him for 30 years. I consider him
amazing.
A close friend, and Hal Putoff. And you went to the right place to start, especially with a focus, your focus toward materials and the material side of this, but interestingly enough, you were also introduced to the spiritual side of it, which is huge as well. So, I'd like to get back just briefly to those hieroglyphics. Can you describe perhaps, looking at all of the different hieroglyphic languages in the world, which one would you say they looked most like, or can you, or were they just too different?
They were certainly different, but, you know, it's not like I'm an expert in hieroglyphic languages in the first place, but, you know, after Googling around, the closest match I've come to is ancient Egyptian. That's by far the most similar in terms of the width, the way that the characters are made. You know, that's about as close as it gets. And now I have no idea if it was ancient Egyptian, of course, but, you know,
because they
similar in terms of the way it was made.
They communicate to me in hieroglyphics a lot. I mean, quite often. The last time was just a few weeks ago.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and what I found...
Wow.
Initially, I did not understand it at all. I began to study Egyptian hieroglyphics. I read a marvelous, the best book I read about them was called The Dawning Moon of the Mind by Susan Brind Morrow, which gave me insight into how hieroglyphics worked and what the Egyptians thought, were thinking when they were creating them. And I found, and lately the hieroglyphics that I see have become much more complex and much less pictorial, and they have become, I don't understand them consciously, but I find myself able to act on them after I see them. It's very, very interesting. So we sort of share this method of communication, and if it ever comes to you again, just let it happen. Look at them. Don't try to interpret them on the spur of the moment. And I have a feeling that the meaning will float up in your mind at some point if it's anything like what's happening to me. Now, I want to get on though, because we are only together for half an hour in this year-end show. I'd like to talk a little bit about materials. Now, I should tell you that I do have some. I have some of the material that is presently supposedly under study that Linda Moulton Howe sold to the TTSA.
TTSA?
Right. I have some of that same material here in my office. And
that's amazing.
Well, we've studied it a little bit at Southwest Research in Texas back in 1997, but we didn't do much more than put it under an SEM. We found that it was layered bismuth and magnesium, and we were unable to see in the microscope, the 600 power microscope or in the SEM, any sign of any adhesive material between the layers. So it's a very interesting little fragment of material. We don't know what it is at all. I want to ask you another question. You're familiar with the materials that were analyzed and found to have isotopic ratios that are not of Earth and, in fact, not of this universe. Are you familiar with those?
Yes, the one where the isotopic ratios are evenly distributed.
Yes. What do you make of that? What possible reason could there be for that?
So, yeah, it's a great question. And I think, like, my answer is in two parts. The first one is, let's look at, you know, what can cause those kinds of isotopic ratios, right? So I looked at, and you've already pointed out that, as you already, alluded to, you know, these isotopic ratios seem to be unnatural. They are not, they're well beyond terrestrial isotopic ratios for each respective element that's found inside those materials. And so the next best, you know, guess that we can take is, okay, is there some sort of engineering process that might account for it? And that, like, you know, in 2020 and in the 21st century, there may just be some sort of one-off engineering process or multiple processes that people have discovered, but in none of these processes would it be cheap, you know, to produce anything like this. And of course, these materials are extremely old. They weren't found in the 21st century to begin with. The third thing, though, which is also interesting, is that, you know, I've spoken to some astrophysicists about this, and I was just trying to understand, you know, is there some sort of nucleosynthesis process, some sort of any astronomical process that might produce evenly distributed isotopic ratios? And there's just not, it's just not something that you would naturally expect. And of course, you know, these nucleostellar processes, they create certain very well-defined abundance ratios and distributions that don't follow at all what we're seeing. So the next part of my answer is then, you know, what do we make of this? You know, why would anybody create such a thing? What would these materials be useful for? And so one of the sort of dual purposes of the technology that we're building at Reactive Q is to answer these questions. Once you can simulate materials and you can do it better and with greater accuracy than any, you know, human can, what we can start doing is working backwards and reverse engineering materials with exotic properties like this one to figure out if there is anything that these materials are capable of that we haven't thought of yet, any properties they might have in certain environments that just haven't been simulated yet or put them under.
So, well, that's great because, you know, we had very limited resources at the time, and we were at Southwest Research Institute in Texas, which is very well equipped. And this was also 1997, and, you know, computing and so forth are leap years beyond where we were then. It was William Mallow, who was at that time, he's now deceased, the head of materials science at Southwest Research. So he had access to everything that they had. And we, were not able to do more than to determine the mineral content and to discover this strange effect, the apparent strange effect. I wouldn't say that we proved it, but that's what it looked like. Now, I'd like to move on, if I can, to some of your tweets. Folks, if you're on Twitter, definitely follow Deep Prasad at Deep Neuron. It is very definitely worth it. Okay.
Thank you, Whitley.
Yeah, it's for sure. Here's a tweet. I said this in the summer, and I'll say it again. The UFO community has no idea what they're dealing with. Trojan horses exist, and time will reveal all. Not everyone is your friend. Tread carefully. Now, you say that into the context of a world that is hungry for disclosure, and I suspect you're as concerned as I am. What are your concerns?
Yes, sir. So my concern is that it's twofold. The first one is a little bit more obvious. You know, we are looking to, exactly as you said, you know, people are hungry for disclosure. And when people are desperate for something, they're easily manipulated, right? And so what I'm worried about is that there are people who are purposely spreading disinformation or gaining sort of authority in the field, and whether they know it or not, they're misleading people, right? So that's always a real concern. The second one is people who seem to, in my opinion, are trying to control information and the way that it's disseminated, and sort of, you know, they're trying to seem like I would describe them as wolves in sheep clothing. Like, they're gaining trust from everybody, yet they act totally differently when it comes down to it, you know, behind closed doors. And it's kind of strange and concerning.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because you're talking to someone who's been in a pickle about this for a long time, because I have I have a lot of information from the visitors that is also classified. I don't have a security clearance, so I'm not classified, but I do know people who are, and I trade information with them all the time and discuss issues that are present in that level of this. And because the visitors are telling me to keep my trap shut, I just kind of am edging into it in my public life. Like, this is the first time I've ever said that. And so we'll see what they say, well, how they react to that. Because I see around me, I see, TTSA and the UAP phenomenon becoming more and more open. And so I'm trying to sort of see what happens when I say a little more. Because I've got a lot I could say, a lot. So
I can imagine.
Well, yeah. And then there are other people in the same boat, some of them who do have clearances, who would like to speak out. And one in particular I know who tried to move into a more public space very, very carefully and got really batted down by his own superiors, and others that are just having to keep their mouths shut. But boy, I'm telling you, there's a floodgate that could open, and not all of it is pretty. I mean, some of it's very exciting, I have to admit, and the most exciting parts actually, in my mind, don't have anything to do with the material side of it. It's the spiritual side. And that gets me to my next question for you. That was something that you were kind of opened up to during your encounter. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So during my experience, for example, one thing that near the end of it, for at least, I would say, 2 to 3 minutes, I experienced complete and utter bliss. Like, it was a level of euphoria I've never experienced before. And during that time, I got, let's say, a rush of thoughts or maybe communication or what have you, however you'd like to describe it. Just abstract information that wasn't being given to me verbally. It was as if I was just gaining knowledge or understanding right there on the spot. And one of the feelings that sort of was overwhelming was the idea that there was a couple. So one was the fact that it felt as if the universe itself was alive. Like, that's the best way I can describe it, was that it had its own awareness, and that it was completely aware of our existence, of my existence.
Yeah.
Another one was that, right? It's very strange.
I'm laughing because three quarters of my listeners are going to know exactly what you're talking about, because they are in this too, very deep. Go ahead.
That's awesome. I'm glad. Yeah, it's never good to be alone. So Another one was this concept or this feeling of remembering that this was going to happen, that I knew that this was going to happen eventually, that it was somehow planned, or, you know, like, I just knew, like, some part of my mind knew that this was all very natural. It was just a part of the universe and the way that it worked, and that I was just remembering now that this was just going to happen. And that in itself is strange. And another one was, of course, the feeling of the fact that the universe is frankly teeming with life, and that it's not just, when I think deeper about it, it wasn't just that, you know, it was referring to, or that feeling wasn't just about biological creatures around the galaxy or different galaxies. It just felt like there's just a whole spectrum of life that we're not totally aware of, and sometimes we are, but that we shouldn't fear it. That was part of, you know, the message. And so after, you know, even the following days and weeks after this experience, I remember distinctly not being able to feel any level of anxiety, any level of let's say, fear or really even sadness, feeling extremely, like, loving towards my environment and towards everybody. It was just like I just acknowledged that there was sort of a deeper underlying facet of the universe that I was ignoring or just didn't think about or wasn't aware of. And so that made me think about spirituality.
So that basic sense of there being a larger consciousness that we are kind of inside, that we are part of in a way, but also separate from, is also very, very familiar. Obviously, not only in the close encounter phenomenon and people in it, but in the wider community. Here you is another interesting tweet. Over the next few years and beyond, I'll be advocating for a global public UFO recovery program. We need something that isn't owned by any single entity, organization, or country, whereby all parties involved agree to peacefully capture a genuine UFO and dissect it for science. Now, I thought to myself, I wonder if a team of mice would have a whole lot of luck capturing a lion. So what does that tweet mean?
It's a great tweet. I mean, sorry, great question.
It was a great tweet, too.
That's funny. So the way that I look at it is, yes, you're absolutely right, that if, for example, you know, let's say that being just nice here in terms of the technological difference in comparison, you know, at our best case scenario, we're looking at us being 17th century villagers trying to use our best weapons or bows and arrows to take down an F-18 as it flies above our heads. It's probably not going to happen, even if we wanted it to. But assuming that some of these UFOs are truly machines, then the law of probability, you know, just states that eventually one of these machines will fail. And if we're to take some of the hints that were given by people who have run, you know, these UFO programs like the Lulazanas of the world, it's possible that some of these UAPs do indeed crash, or that there have been recoveries. And if that's the case, then I think that rather than leaving it for just one country, and having this sort of stovepiping of data and information, it would be a whole lot better if all the public had access to something like this, technology like this, that, and really the existence and definitive proof of life out there. That would change the world, you know, profoundly. And the only thing that I can see from why that doesn't happen, why, let's say, if there are crash recoveries, why aren't different programs out there just telling people about it and greeting in civilian scientists? The main reason that I can see is that it's a matter of national security. People don't want to risk, let's say, giving away advanced scientific knowledge or insight to adversaries who might have a better chance at reverse engineering those insights. So imagine if we instead had some sort of treaty, some sort of global organization which was owned by no single entity or country, and it had tons of rules in place and checks to make sure that nobody's using it against humanity in a negative way. maybe we might be able to conceivably, peacefully recover these UAPs and actually make sense of the information. But it's just I think it's just worth a shot.
Well, you know, many people, one of them used to come to our cabin frequently, and actually, to be honest with you, it took people on rides, some of whom are now gradually become willing to talk about it. And when you walked near it, it felt like a living being. It felt like more like walking up to a horse than a machine, if you can get what I mean. I just wonder how close we are, if there's any accuracy to that statement, to understanding what they are, because this was something you could get into and move around in. I mean, it would take them up like, it was like the most extraordinary, ride in a theme park ride you could possibly imagine, because they would be taken up to the edge of the atmosphere and even farther sometimes, and then brought back in a matter of minutes. And I was once taken to Boulder, Colorado, and interacted with a family there, and it changed all of our lives completely what happened. And to this day, still, it's one of the central realities in my life because of that 15-minute trip in that thing. So, you know, what's this about? When we talk about machines, do we even have any idea what we're talking about?
That's fascinating and a very good question as well. So one thing that I think about is that I like to say often is that the last thing we'll reverse engineer about a UAP, a physical one, let's say, is the computing system or whatever information system is inside of it that allows it to manipulate information, whether it's conscious, whatever it may be, however it may think, that is the last thing that we'll be able to figure out. And the reason why that is because the level of technology that it takes to create a very powerful information processing system is often far more complex than just getting something to, let's say, fly. You know, we've had airplanes for about 100 years now, and, you know, those flight principles, once we figured them out, we just kept improving and iterating on them. But let's say, for example, you know, somebody in the 1940s, they see an F-18 and they see it traveling at almost 2 times the speed of sound. It wouldn't be all that surprising to them. You know, they would be able to figure out, okay, it has wings. Our planes have wings. It's probably, you know, using an engine. You know, we have engines. But imagine if that F-18 had a quantum computer on board that was actually using, you know, the data and let's say data from quantum sensors that has integrated into the system. People in the 1940s would have no idea what a quantum computer was. Quantum mechanics was just 10 years old at that time, in its full and final form. So let alone being able to process or conceptualize the idea, which came in the 1980s by Richard Feynman, the concept of a machine that processes information using quantum mechanics as its fundamental sort of unit of information. So that would make it exponentially harder for that would be the last thing that such a person in the 1940s would be able to understand. So, you know, I would love to later hear more about this experience. You know, we don't have to do it now, but that's fascinating. You know, oftentimes when people do report being on some of these UAPs and UFOs, they often do say that there is almost a sentience that the machine itself has.
Yeah,
and
that's how it feels.
Wow, there you go. And so to me, that is going to be the last thing that we truly understand and reverse engineer. It may be based on physics and science we don't even have yet, but we can at least understand, you know, that the thing is flying or vectating or however you'd like to call it. We can conceptualize that and perhaps how it's using energy sources and maybe find one. But that's really about it. The way that the computer information is probably extremely complex.
Deep, we're going to talk again and more deeply, if you will, over the course of this coming year. But I do have a last thought. My last thought is this.
Sure.
They came to you because they knew that would work. What do you think of that?
if you mean they knew that it would work in making me obsessed with how things work, how then I would say it worked.
It did work.
You're quite smart.
Well, you're incredibly...
Let's just hope that it wasn't a waste.
You're incredibly brilliant. You're at the absolute cutting edge of one of the most important fields in human technology now, which is artificial intelligence. And you're in contact with them. Folks, what does that tell you about the future? To me, it tells you there's good stuff to come. Deep Prasad, thank you so much for joining us on our year-end Dreamland special.
Thank you so much, Whitley. It's an honor and always a pleasure.
Ancient Rome was a place of great wealth, great ignorance, and great fear. They had no idea how nature works or even what they themselves were. They attributed all fortune, good and bad, to their gods. They saw disease as a supernatural punishment. They knew nothing of germ theory. Their lives were hard and short. Most of them were dead before they were 50, and during the series of pandemics that started around 150 AD, millions upon millions of them died in agony, terror, and ignorance. Their great solace was their gods. Even when they were starving, dying of sickness, or being oppressed by barbarian immigrants, they would sacrifice to them for protection. When climate change, pandemics, and uncontrollable migration, sound familiar, began to topple their empire, they called on these gods for help. As they didn't exist, however, they naturally failed to answer. From the mid-100s of the present era and for another 500 years, Rome endured devastating droughts, horrific pandemics, and unstoppable migrations into the empire by outsiders who did not in any way share their laws, their customs, their ideas, or their way of life. What happened over that time is arguably the single most dramatic and important series of events in all of history. Fighting back, but with the wrong weapons, they replaced their old gods with a new one, Christ. He lives on in Constantine's creed, the Creed of Nicaea, less so in the teachings of Jesus. While Christianity has been a great good in the world, it has, due to its often brutal enforcement of its creed, also been a force for evil. There is another Jesus, and this book is about him and his life and afterlife, and what he actually taught, or rather, what he showed his students how to find for themselves, and which we can also find. Next up, Jeff Kripal. The flip. What is the flip? Well, it sounds like something that an acrobat might do, and that is entirely true. An acrobat might do a flip and might do more than one flip, but there's an entirely different kind of flip in this world. And we are talking today to my beloved co-author of Supernatural and dear friend. I regard him as the most modest genius I have ever known, and he is probably quaking with embarrassment that I even said that. Jeff Kripal is with us to help us across the divide between 2020 and 2021 by discussing his marvelous little book, and I mean it's little, The Flip. Okay, Jeff, let's start by talking about what do you mean, flip?
Well, welcome. Thanks, Whitley, for the lovely introduction. So the flip is little, isn't it? It's the shortest book I've ever written. And I was looking for a language that could capture something really, really important, but also in really, really simple language. And the flip, it seemed appropriate. What I mean by it is people who are trained to think of the world in completely materialistic ways, scientists, engineers, medical professionals, and then they have some kind of experience that literally turns their worldview inside out. What they thought about the world as only being an outside, only being material, they now realize also has an interior, has an inside. And I call this transformation the flip, to kind of get a sense of what it involves.
It happened to you.
Yeah, I mean, it did happen to me. I suppose it did. It, very gradually, but also suddenly, once or twice, but also mostly through thinking and talking to other people like yourself. And that's kind of what the book is about, that these flips can sneak up on you until it's too late, as it were.
Until it's, you can't get away, exactly. Well, I talk about, on Dreamland, I talk very frequently to people who have experienced the flip without entirely understanding that. Now, let's go into some of the wonderful stories in this book, in the flip. Let's start, for example, with mental telegraphy and Mark Twain. That's an example of a flip that changed his whole way of thinking about the world.
Yeah, I mean, this book is, you know, it has a kind of design or a kind of strategy to it. It's a kind of Trojan horse strategy. And the idea was, you know, I work in a university that's filled with young people who are going to be engineers and scientists and medical professionals, and they're very proud of their scientific training. I think sometimes too proud. And I decided at some point that if I just talked about these experiences with, you know, kind of classical religious figures, that they're too easy to dismiss. And so I started to talk about major kind of literary figures and scientists and engineers like them who have had a similar kind of experience and are much more difficult to dismiss. And Mark Twain is one of these people. You know, the book begins with Mark Twain, who was this, of course, great American humorist and writer, but who also had any number of what we would today call paranormal experiences around precognition, but which he linked directly to his own literary creativity, his ability to write. So he's this fascinating figure that not only had these experiences, but used them to become the writer he became. And that's really the kind of deeper argument of the book, is that these experiences aren't tangential. They aren't just marginal in any way. They're actually at the core of these people we revere today and still read.
Can you tell us a little bit about what happened to him specifically in 1858 that was such a...
Well,
yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, many, many things happened to Twain. He tried to write about them in Harper's Weekly, one of these great magazines of the time, and he wanted to write about them anonymously. And, of course, the editor wasn't going to publish the most famous writer of the time anonymously, so wouldn't let him do that. So he eventually did publish these two essays, both of which were called Mental Telegraphy. Probably the most dramatic event, and certainly the most poignant, was he went to sleep and had a dream of his brother's funeral, laid out in a borrowed suit in a metal casket with a particular kind of bouquet laid on his chest consisting of one color of flower with a single red rose in the middle. And he woke up from this dream, and it was so real that he, you know, put his clothes on or got ready to go to the funeral home until he realized that, you know, it was just a dream. His brother was perfectly alive and fine. Well, a couple weeks later, through a series of events, working on a steamboat, he was separated from his brother, and his brother was actually mortally burned in a boiler explosion, and was given an overdose of narcotic by the young doctors and perished and died. And when Twain walked into the funeral home, he witnessed the exact scene that he had dreamed of, you know, a few weeks before, and of course recognized this immediately, and then watched as a woman came in and laid this exact bouquet on his brother's chest. So he was, you know, he was deeply moved by this, as any of us would be, and felt that it had something to do with him being connected to his own future self. And, you know, as with us today, he used the technology of the time as a, the most appropriate analogy, which was, of course, the telegram. That was the internet of the time. And so he called this mental telegraphy.
He's just one of many. We'll talk about more of them in a few minutes. But right now, I'd like to ask you this. Why is the world as it is? Do you have a clear answer to that? In other words, you make reference to your students, the students at Rice, not probably the ones who take your courses, or maybe so, I don't know, but certainly to many of them who would just disdain anything like that. And yet the literature of experiences like that is so gigantic that it can't actually rationally be dismissed. It's called, always the skeptics say, well, it's anecdotal, but it's not. It's commonplace. It's a way of living. I mean, I could pick up a book right now, right at hand on this desk, that has hundreds and hundreds of such experiences related in it by ordinary people. I'm not going to pick the book up because we're not talking about that. But my point is this. This flip is going on all the time and has been for years. Why do we deny it?
Well, I mean, that to me is the ultimate question. I think what's happening is all of these stories you're talking about, which of course are very real, and sometimes the most important things that ever happened to these people, again, these are not tangential stories. This is like the Twain dream of his own brother's death. These get suppressed by the social censor of the time. You know, I mean, people feel reluctant to tell these stories, or they feel ashamed, or they don't want to be called crazy or be dismissed. So they don't talk about them. And as a result, we have all of these millions of stories and experiences out there, virtually all of which are not being talked about, and only a few of which get through the social censor. So we imagine that these are just odd, strange stories that don't matter. Let's just call them anecdotes and be done with it. It's simply a rhetoric. It's a kind of gaslighting, essentially, that the skeptical or debunking community engages in to preserve a particular ideology, which is essentially scientific materialism. And that's, for some reason, that's the world they want to live in. I'm not entirely sure, because it's an incredibly limiting and depressing worldview, but that seems to be what they want to protect. And I suspect that they want to protect it, or that people in general want to protect it, because it does do good things. I mean, that world makes cool stuff.
Yeah.
Mean, that world just made an immunization for COVID-19. I mean, it's an incredibly powerful worldview that does really good stuff. The problem is that it completely has to erase us or ignore us in the process. It has absolutely no way of understanding or explaining us. And so we kind of make this deal with the devil that, okay, we'll live in this world because we can have refrigerators and, you know, immunization shots. But in the meantime, we're completely stripped of meaning and purpose, and we're just kind of lost at sea. And I think that's kind of where we're at.
You know, that gets me to A.J. Ayer and his experience, which is a perfect one to talk about right now.
Yeah.
Tell us about who A.J. Ayer was and what this experience was.
Well, A.J. Ayer was one of the greatest of the Anglo-analytic philosophers, and a really well-known atheist, deeply skeptical of any kind of truth claim that couldn't be established with very clear thinking and very highly defined words. And he was famously dismissive of all forms of religious belief, particularly immortality or the survival of bodily death. And when he was older, he was hospitalized. I don't know. I don't recall. But he was eating some salmon and choked on it and basically had a near-death experience and had this very elaborate experience of the other side and these beings that control space-time. It was actually a pretty bizarre kind of near-death experience. But he came back from this experience and he basically said, "Wow, that was pretty awesome." I mean, he was British, so he didn't say that. But
he
said
you were all mad.
Yeah, yeah. He said you were all mad, and that was an ambiguous thing to say because it wasn't clear whether it was referring to the medical establishment who were so certain that there was no afterlife, or whether, you know, it referred to something else. It wasn't clear. And the more he thought about the experience, the most he would say in the end was that the experience removed his certainty about there not being anything after death, which doesn't sound like a lot, Whitley, but for A.J. Ayer, that's a big deal, you know.
It's huge.
That's really a reversal of his entire life work in some way. So yeah, I mean, he flipped essentially, or he almost flipped. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, he almost flipped. He didn't quite flip, but since he died in 1989, he's now thoroughly flipped.
Yeah, as we all will be. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the book is filled with stories like that, and I don't want to pretend that everybody successfully flips. As I say often in interviews, well, you know, sometimes people just flop. They don't
yeah.
really flip, or they flip halfway and land on their head or something. I mean, these experiences are not always successful or complete. Sometimes they just really create doubt in the person and they're not as so damn certain anymore. But sometimes they really do flip a person, and the person is absolutely convinced that things are no longer just as simple as they once were. There is an inside to the world. It's not just about the outside.
You know, there's a level of resistance inside us. I remember we had a group of people at our cabin, old friends. We didn't do much without most of all of the experiences at the cabin were obviously with friends and a few people Anne had chosen. But we were sitting in a circle in the woods at the spot where I thought I had been taken up. A group of us were meditating together. And suddenly this shaft of just exquisitely beautiful golden light came down into the middle of the circle from above. We were in a little clearing in the woods, and everyone could see it. We were all talking about it, except one person, Dr. John Glideman. And Dr. Glideman was looking right at it and couldn't see it. And then for the rest of the day, he was incapacitated by a ferocious headache that I think was his brain literally pushing away this extraordinary, frankly miraculous sight, because he could not afford to, it would have burst his whole paradigm. It would have ruined his entire worldview. He just couldn't afford to see it. Now, isn't that sort of fundamental to what's changing? That scene where a lot of people do see it, and they are deeply moved by it, but one person can't because he can't afford to. Are they kind of running out of can't afford to? Or do you think more of them are flipping or not?
I mean, I get asked that all the time, Whitley, and I don't know the answer to that. The one thing I would say is I think our sciences are becoming more and more humble, and they're hitting a wall around basic questions. So I think gradually we are flipping as a culture, but I think it's really gradual.
Very much so. And yet there are people like, goodness, let's see, Well, let's talk a little bit about Michael Shermer.
Yeah.
The skeptic.
Michael's a really wonderful example, actually. You know, a really good guy and really honest. You know, he edits the Skeptic magazine and has really, in some ways, made a career of deconstructing or debunking a lot of these things. And yet, he himself had just such a paranormal experience on his wedding day and wrote about it in a really honest, I thought, admirable and fair way. And it essentially involved, it was essentially involved a radio going on in a drawer and playing the exact song that his bride-to-be needed to hear at that point, that was the favorite song of her dead grandfather. And, you know, basically everyone broke out in tears because of this sort of magical coincidence. And Michael Shermer very correctly says, look, what made this uncanny was not the physics of it or why the radio went on at that time. It was the timing. It was the uncanny timing of this and the fact that it played the exact song at the exact time that my bride needed to hear this. And he just told the story. And he was like, I get it. I get why people, you know, say these things. And so did that make him flip or change his worldview? No. But I think it's a lot like the Ayer experience. Of choking on the salmon and having the near-death experience, it made him a little less certain. And so that's all I'm asking for. I understand why people are skeptical, and I understand why people have materialist worldviews, and I really honor their precision and their reasoning and their science. But when you get a case like Michael Shermer, I'm impressed, you know, because of, you know, the honesty involved in it. And so that was one of the stories I tell in the book, is that particular story.
Yeah, exactly. And Barbara Ehrenreich is another wonderful story.
Yeah.
And I believe I met Barbara at one point in a conference with you. Is that correct?
No. Not with me, Whitley. I've never met Barbara. She's a famous feminist social critic who writes about things like, you know, capitalism and the economy and poverty, and, you know, has really been a social activist her whole life and an avid atheist. And then, you know, a few years ago, she released this autobiography called Living with a Wild God. Basically, she tells the story of having this incredible mystical experience as a teenager in Northern California on a skiing trip, and how this really just kind of shattered her and has stayed with her whole life, but she has felt a need to suppress it her whole life to kind of, you know, be a rational, you know, social critic and feminist writer. And I think as she nears the end of life, like all of us, I mean, she felt a real need to come to terms with this. And so she wrote this really beautiful book called Living with a Wild God, which I also talk about. So did that flip her? I don't know. You'd have to ask her. It seems to have, though, if you read the book. I mean, it's a really powerful story.
Yeah, I've read the book, and it is a powerful story. And and you have to wonder, given her life, what was going on in her mind all of those years after that happened?
And how she suppressed it, you know? I mean, you know, it's kind of like your friend who had the headache. I mean, I think it takes a lot of energy to keep these things forgotten.
Well, yeah, you know, the summer before I had the close encounter experience in 1985, I was literally being plagued by headaches every day. And I have a feeling I was pushing something away even then that I just had no idea about. I want to talk now and shift a little bit to a writer that you and I both really think is important, Bernardo Kastrup.
Yeah.
And can you tell us a little bit about his work? And I hope I can interview him on Dreamland. I looking forward to trying to do that.
I can talk about Bernardo. I've read all of his books, actually, I think. I think he's written 8 books now. I've read every single one of them. Bernardo has 2 PhDs. One, I believe, I want to say in computer science. I could be wrong about that, but it's in the sciences. And the second PhD was in philosophy. And Bernardo Kastrup is a very articulate idealist, by which I mean he is fundamentally committed to a worldview in which mind is fundamental. And the material world is real, but also secondary or somehow a function of mind. And he articulates this worldview in these 8 books in really extraordinary and often funny ways. And I just find his thought so rigorous and so clear and so engaging. I don't always understand it because I have not been graced with, I think, the experiences Bernardo has been graced with, but I appreciate it and I want to understand it. I think he's probably the most important philosopher of idealism working today. I think I can say that with real conviction.
Tell us non-philosophers what idealism is.
Well, again, idealism is the position. So materialism, which is what most people are today, is the position that fundamentally reality is made of matter and that what we think of as mind is just a function or a product of matter behaving in particularly sophisticated ways in our brains. Idealism is the exact reverse of that. It's that mind actually is fundamental or primary and matter is a function of the behavior of mind, essentially. And in Bernardo's case, mathematics is an expression of mind, and it reveals itself to other mentalities or subjectivities through the senses and through cognition in the material world, which is really just mind that we're projecting outwards.
Well, you know, the interesting thing, if you think about mathematics and you think about someone like Max Tegmark's book about the mathematics of the universe, that math, the formulas that reality is based on had to have preceded reality. They had to have been there before.
Right. So Bernardo would be critical of Tegmark. You know, Tegmark's very much a materialist, but also something of a Platonist, which is really what you're talking about, Willie, that math, you know, Platonism basically says mathematics isn't invented, it's discovered, and that these mathematical principles pre-exist their expression in the material world. That you know, mathematics is real in some sense.
Right. It has to be. There had to be there before anything existed, and no matter how you cut it, that's the truth. The flip, such a fascinating journey. Jeff, thank you so much for being with us. And Jeff Kripal will be with us on and off on Dreamland, I'm sure, for many years to come, as long as I last and Jeff lasts. And goodness knows, going down the road, what kind of flips will we be flipping out with? Happy New Year. Merry Christmas, Jeff, and Happy New Year.
All right, let's have a better 2021.
Oh, my God, let's hope.
Yeah.
And now let's get back to Jesus, a New Vision from the introduction. Perhaps the worst effect of the elevation of Jesus to the status of a God has been to send us the message that we can never truly become what he was and is. That is not what he wanted. He wanted us, not our worship. In this book, I take a new look at his life and what came after, exploring not only the conventional story, but the deeper story that has been buried under the weight of belief. The picture of Jesus that emerges is radically different, not only from traditional Christian beliefs, but also from modern secular assumptions. Jesus was not a god, but he was also much more than the teacher and zealot portrayed by modern scholarship. He was indeed a miracle worker, but his miracles were not supernatural. Rather, there are explanations, and they are every bit as remarkable as the man himself. Similarly, something extremely strange really did happen after his crucifixion. Indeed, I think it is safe to say that it was the strangest thing that has ever been documented in human experience. Next up, we're going to be talking to Mitch Horowitz about the nature of the soul and that journey. His website is MitchHorowitz.com. Who is Mitch Horowitz? Well, he's many people. Among them, he was for many years an editor at Tarcher Penguin. He edited and published The Key, Solving the Communion Enigma, and Supernatural. Over the years, he has become a great friend, and I admire enormously the work of Mitch Horowitz. If you go to MitchHorowitz.com, you will find some of his work. And if you go to Amazon, say, or wherever you buy books, you'll find more. The Seeker's Guide to the Secret Teachings of All Ages is his most recent book. And it is, I've read it, and it is a marvelous journey into the work of Manly P. Hall. And why don't you tell us, Mitch, who Manly P. Hall was before we go on? And we're going to explore a lot of different areas just before I give it over to Mitch, among them the journey of the soul that's taking place now that is so profound. But tell us first about the book, about The Seeker's Guide.
Well, Manly P. Hall was, for many years, the preeminent scholar of all things esoteric and occult here in the United States. He died in 1990, and he is best known for his 1928 book, The Secret Teachings of All Ages, which is just an extraordinary encyclopedia arcanum of traditions from esoteric and occult and mystery religions around the world. It's a wonderful magisterial analysis of symbols and myth and parable and secret teachings, as the title implies. Manly published the book when he was only 27 years old, so there's a mystery in his own background as to how someone with no traditional education at so young an age was able to prepare and publish entirely on his own such a magisterial work. It's one of the most significant compendiums of occult wisdom ever published in any time. So he was a truly remarkable figure and, in some regards, an enigma.
Well, yeah, he sure was an enigma because having delved into it, I cannot say I have read the whole book, unlike you. But it's unbelievable that it was the work of such a young man. It seems as almost if he was inhabited by somebody else. Go ahead.
There's something that could justifiably be called a mystery behind his ability to produce a book like that at so young an age. In The Seeker's Guide, I try to get into that question. You know, of course, there's all sorts of speculations about reincarnations and genii spirits and things of that nature. But I would say that there's a lesson in Manly's life that when you find the right marriage of person to topic, when you find that passion that arises from placing yourself in proximity to the right subject matter, if you're a writer, or the right people, you know, whoever you are in whatever walk of life, there is a exponential effect. There's a multiplying effect. Remarkable things happen that aren't easy to explain. Enthusiasm, inspiration, which is rooted in the word spirit, these are meaningful terms, and we use them so often they come to seem overly familiar. But when you speak in terms of inspiration, you're speaking in terms of the driving force behind a book like The Secret Teachings of All Ages. Even that doesn't get at the full story, but I think it's a piece of the story, which is why I'm always counseling people to watch very, very carefully for their passions and do everything they can to attach themselves to those passions.
Now, that's a very interesting statement, because it's very much in the direction of what I was thinking we would talk about today, because we're going across the change of the year from 2020 to 2021. And 2020 has been a notable year on so many different levels. It's a historic year. I'm, of course, no prognosticator. I wouldn't dare to suggest I know anything about what 2021 will be. But a lot of people were placed under unusual pressure in 2020, mental pressure, physical pressure, pressure from loss of income, from the danger of disease and getting COVID many cases. It's gone through some friends of mine have died of it, and I'm sure you know some people who have gotten sick or possibly died as well. Most of us do.
Sure.
Go ahead.
I had COVID myself in March, April, actually.
Oh, wow. I did not know that.
Yeah. I was lucky. I mean, it was probably what you'd consider a mild case, but it laid me up for about 2 months.
2 months?
Yeah. Oh, no joke.
Well, that's exactly what I was talking about. One of the things I've felt, I had a prediction from my friends, the visitors, last year in March that this would not resolve itself until December. And as it was put, your world will be forever changed. And indeed, December came along and the vaccines rolled out. And now we're looking at a new world. And what the dimension of the soul and consciousness, what do you see as having changed there because of all of this, almost an initiatory pressure, really, from nature, impacting the human species?
Well, it's a wonderful question. It's so hard to have perspective on it because we're just in the midst of it. If I look at my own life, I can't imagine my experience is exceptional. I know that there was a period of time where I personally felt I was doing okay with it, even though I got sick. I was able to convalesce. I got a lot of writing done while I was convalescing. I had to deal with some of the economic fallout, obviously, as everybody has, or as most of us have. That was tough. I was able to get through that. And I find that I am now, as you and I are speaking, in the latter part of December 2020, I am feeling, as I'm sure many, many of your listeners are feeling, a terrible sense of exhaustion with the pandemic, even as I understand the need for the various strictures that are in place. And I probably, to be frank, have not acknowledged to myself the toll that it's taken on me personally, in terms of mood, in terms of anxiety, maybe because we who live in the Northeast, you know, passed through the spring and summer and felt a sense of things lifting. It was easy to paper that over, but with the advent of fall and now winter, the feeling of being locked down has come roaring back in like no time anybody has felt since the month of March. I assume that when this lifts, I assume there is going to be an unbelievable release of energy, almost like a Mercury retrograde cycle coming to an end. But a Mercury retrograde cycle, for those who follow astrology, lasts in the neighborhood of 3 weeks, maybe right. 3.5 weeks. You know, we're dealing with something that's going to go on for 18 months. And it's really... I do know that what I experience when a Mercury retrograde cycle lifts is a feeling of just this pent-up energy suddenly being released, and a feeling of levity and a feeling of almost euphoria. And I think we're going to go through some of that. You know, people have made the case that the Roaring Twenties, the 1920s, actually the very era in which Manly Hall wrote The Secret Teachings of All Ages, that was characterized by this feeling of wildness because people were so eager to leave behind them the shadow of the First World War and the 1918 flu pandemic, which rose out of it. I'd be surprised if we don't have something like that. But of course, we're also going to be dealing with a great deal of economic devastation. You know, the war, horrible as it was, and it was infinitely worse in terms of the human toll it took than anything like what we're experiencing, infinitely worse. However, manufacturing and munitions and industrial expansion and things that go on during wartime were proceeding apace. So the United States, if not the Allies, experienced boom times, you know, following the First World War. We're not going to be experiencing boom times. We're going to be climbing out of a very deep crater. So how that's going to be, how that's going to work, how that's going to gel with the sense of euphoria is a real question to me. It's an unprecedented question. How will a period of what I assume is going to be economic recession, very serious economic recession, gel with a period where people feel liberated once again? I don't know that we've faced that before.
Well, yeah, I don't know exactly what will happen either, but you know, you did mention one thing that the war was infinitely worse, and it was in overall in the world in terms of the total number of deaths. But you know, not in the United States. We've already lost more than 300,000 people, and the total losses in World War One were, I think, more like 115 or 120,000.
Well, actually, the great number of deaths that emerged from the war emerged from the pandemic, the flu pandemic.
Right. Yes. Afterwards, well, that's very true. And then the pandemic, and of course, in those days, they had no way of there was nothing they could do about a pandemic except basically,
right,
you know, just the most minimal things, masking up and isolating people who were sick as best they could. So they were very helpless. There was no, in other words, once a person got sick, there was essentially no medical intervention except palliative care. And
Yes. That's
very definitely not true now. And also we have this miracle of these vaccines that have come along. And if they, do work and don't cause bizarre, unexpected side effects, then yeah, I think we're going to be definitely in a state of recovery. I think that the economic damage is profound and we will, however, get past it because there will be an explosion of just desire. I mean, I know how I feel. I'd like to jump in a plane. I spend about a quarter of my time with my family in Texas and friends in New York, and I haven't been able to do that since February. This all shut down, I was just getting ready to make another trip to Texas.
I was getting ready to go to Texas myself. I was part of a television series called Cursed Film that was part of the South by Southwest Film Festival in Austin. I was getting all ready to go to Austin and participate in activities there, and when everything shut down, it all happened so quickly, it was shocking. But the most profound change, at least here in New York City, and I'm sure in other parts of the country, has been the closing down of the school systems. I mean, that has just left a generation of kids, you know, unmoored. And they're, you know, some of these kids are from disadvantaged backgrounds. Some of them are at very sensitive ages. If a kid doesn't learn to read and write and do arithmetic at ages 8, 9, it's going to be very, very hard to play catch up. And I'm very worried about that generation.
Yeah.
There's going to have to be some special measures there.
Well, there are. And I know my 13-year-old grandson is just miserable without his friends. And he spends all of his time on Discord and God knows where. I mean, where they all are. And, you know, they hang out together constantly, but it's not the same. And they know it. I mean, it's not the same to be online with your friends.
No.
You need to be face-to-face. And
our
little 2-year-old has never laid eyes on another child like him in his life.
That's really something.
Yeah.
These are tough questions. Yeah. These are very tough questions. You know, I mean, one could say that they're, you know, public health is paramount. We can't have emergency rooms. We can't have, intensive care wards, crowded to the point of capacity. our healthcare system will shut down. We can't have that. At the same time, there does reach a point where one has to ask about how great a burden of isolation is being placed on the youngest and the most vulnerable, including economically vulnerable people in our society, and whether this is going to end in time enough to avert profound damage,
yeah.
And whether history will judge us as having dealt well with this pandemic. You know, I think that's very much an open question. At least that's what I feel at the moment.
Well, me too. And, you know, because the problem of the economic damage is so great. There's all of this business, the fights about masking and how it became a political issue, but it's mm-hmm. not a political issue, really. It's an economic issue because people are desperate. I mean,
people are desperate. Yeah.
Absolutely desperate. And, I can very well understand the deep anger that I see around me. And in fact, even some, things that I would consider to be completely insane that people are saying and doing. And it's because of fear and because of the desperate situation they're in. Now I want to shift gears a little bit. I've always thought of you as a person who has a significant knowledge of the literature and, the journey of the soul. And I would like you to start by, if you can, giving us a straightforward, he says laughingly, definition. What do you think the soul is? Is there an eternal part of a human being or not?
Well, that's a fascinating question. I feel certain that we all have an extra physical existence. And in fact, I would even go so far as to say that's a settled point. The prevalence of scholarly ESP research, psychical research in the 20th century, 21st century, the emergence of fields like neuroplasticity, which demonstrate through brain scans the ability of thought to alter the neural matter of the brain, demonstrates beyond question that there is some non-local form of intelligence. There is some measurable, anomalous transfer of information that can be tracked in laboratory settings. And I'm citing just the most basic fields. There are, you know, theoretical questions that emerge from quantum physics and so on that contribute to this discussion. Studies of the placebo response that go far beyond just somebody feeling better from taking a sugar pill that deepen this question. There's no doubt that all of us possess both a physical and an extra-physical existence. Whether that extra-physical existence is what we traditionally call a soul, I really can't say. I speak more in terms of the psyche. I think of the psyche as an amalgam of intellect, of emotion, and of cognitive thought that's familiar to us, as well as something that participates in this non-local intelligence. The Greeks had a phrase, nous, for a higher mind. And it's possible that we do all participate in some kind of a higher mind or an intelligence that can't be classified as being part of cognitive skill and motor function. There's something greater. There's something non-physical. Is that the soul? I'm not sure. Does that survive death in any way that is personified? I'm not sure, but that we have an extra physical existence, I have no doubt of.
And where will we go with this? In other words, is it being affected by the world around us? And this is an old question. When you look at the catastrophes of the past, well, for example, there was a pandemic in the world. It was worse than the Black Death. It's been more or less forgotten. It's called the Plague of Justinian, and it probably killed 60% of the population of the Roman Empire. And in fact, it was one of the main reasons the Roman Empire collapsed, simply mm-hmm. because there was nobody left in many parts of the empire at all alive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And out of that, there before that happened, or began, there were basically two great strains of religion in in the Roman Empire. One was the old polytheistic religion with its mysteries and its great wisdom. And the other was the new religion of Christianity that had about 100 years before been adopted by Constantine. And during this period, there was a violent backlash against the old religion. And mm-hmm. this is why you see all of the statues with their noses broken off and so forth, and the temples were all pulled down. People were literally running through the streets, destroying everything that had been of the past.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, it's as if the soul was recoiling against something. So, mm-hmm. so deep. How do you respond to that?
I do believe that, and I, and you've known me for a long time, and you know I resist talking easily about or offhandedly about paradigm shifts or quantum leaps or evolutionary advances or, you know, expansions of human consciousness. I think we talk about that stuff, we as a culture, especially the alternative spiritual culture that I'm part of, we talk about that stuff far too easily and far too casually, just in the same way we talk about apocalypse too easily and too casually. But it is very difficult to avoid the sense that we really are poised on some sort of a precipice, something in addition to the plague and the frictions of the election cycle, serious as that is, occurred in 2020. I would say in 2019, 2020, we really saw the mainstreaming of the UFO question, for example, these cockpit videos that the Department of Defense released were known about before, but the fact that they were released openly and freely and with widespread mainstream coverage and viewing, I think probably represented a kind of turning point in the public's perception of itself and UFOs. No serious person could maintain today that the UFO question is not relevant or that it's based on mistakes or delusions or natural phenomena. It's clearly artificial phenomena, by which I mean engineered phenomena. Where it's from, what it is, we have no idea. But that UFOs are engineered phenomena, I think no serious person would question in the here and now. That's new. That's change. And I think with that change, we're probably also going to see advances in psychical research, a field that at the university level has been subject to, I would say, a kind of intellectual cold war that's been very successful for the past generation or so. And I think we're going to see that field rebounding. And I believe that we're also developing a sense that life of some kind, even if it's primordial, may be general to our solar system. There's evidence for microbial life past or present on Venus, on Mars. Water has recently been discovered on the sunlit side of the moon. These were things, if you talked about such things when I was a kid, you would have been considered nuts. But today, this is ordinary stuff, as you could read in the science pages of any newspaper or magazine. So something is changing in the human psyche, and I think we're probably going to undergo a change in our perception of human nature on as significant a scale as the Victorians did when Darwinism became widely accepted and understood. You know, suddenly man no longer saw himself as just this projection or creation of God, but was part of a biological evolutionary order along with everything else in the natural world, along with inanimate forms of life. And it's hard to believe that with the advances in our understanding of non-locality, with the embrace in the mainstream of the UFO thesis, with the discovery of more generalized life in our solar system, that we're not going to have some new sense, or at least the next generation will have some new sense of what it means to be human. I have no doubt that what we're seeing right now is occurring, as all things do, within a certain context. These discoveries are not just going to stop. I think we're on the precipice of something.
I do too. And I, you know, I respect your unwillingness to talk about paradigm shift and so forth. I don't actually believe in sudden paradigm shift or even visible paradigm shift. I think that I think this is much more like a gigantic ship, the ship of the human experience, traveling a dark ocean. And we really don't have too many ways of detecting things like direction. The future comes at us as if out of a fog.
Yes.
And that's kind of where we are now. What is your sense, though, of – well, first I'll tell you mine, to be fair. My sense of 2020 is that it's going to be a very complex year. I'm not so sure that it's going to be that different from 2020. I do think it is going to be there are going to be more challenges simply because of I see things like climate change taking place and other and the immensely restless political situation, and not just in the United States. It's true in many, many parts of the world that there is a very distinct division between the kind of what are now sort of old line democracies or republics that have a basic commitment to the freedom of the individual and a new kind of order that is much more, much less interested in that. Let me put it that way.
Yeah. Well, it's funny in a way. I have my attachment to the old order because the old order as it existed in our country and as it existed in Western Europe and Australia, New Zealand, other parts of the world, parts of Asia, that order progressively promoted the rights of the individual, rights of free expression, rights of sexual expression, rights of people to abide by different religions, identities, so forth. And that order has been very good for people like me in a lot of ways.
Me too.
That order, yeah. And that order has also been wed to an increasingly, I would say, predatory form of capitalism, especially in the form of our healthcare economics, that is proving unworkable. And we as a public here in America are unable to fix this, are unable to work this out because we're so divided along cultural lines that even if we may agree, well, you know, perhaps a Canadian-style healthcare system would be better after all, you know, it's in, or, you know, something else, or, you know, UBI, Universal Basic Income. If we agreed on those things, or some mass of us did, it's so difficult to get around what is perceived as these deep cultural differences. I don't find these cultural differences altogether that pronounced on the individual levels, but they obviously get very heavily pronounced when we form into our neighborhoods. And clearly something dramatic is going to change. And I'm not so happy about that, to be perfectly frank with you, because as deeply frustrated as I am with the situation of healthcare economics in our country, with the ways in which the working person is mistreated, and I feel very, very strongly about those things, the kind of liberal mainstream that promoted the rights of the individual has brought a lot of benefits to a lot of people, and I'm one of them.
Yeah,
and I don't think that bargain is going to quite hold up the same way.
No, and when you say liberal, you don't mean the political liberal versus conservative,
right.
You're talking in a deeper way about Western...
More classically liberal system, you know, that values the individual.
Right, which includes liberal politics and conservative politics.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Larry Seidentop wrote a wonderful book about that. And he's a conservative British politician, or British, I should say, academic. Well, Mitch, it's been great and talking to you. I promised you half an hour.
Likewise.
And we're going to go on a very interesting journey in 2021. There's no question about that, at least. That I can predict.
Yeah, well, Whitley, I want to thank you because you have hung in there for many, many decades. You popularized themes that were very, very difficult for people to talk about, you know, going back a generation. And you've given a voice to a lot of people who have had anomalous experiences who felt that they were very alone. And I want to say a word of tribute to you that, you know, you have been hanging in there for a long time. And the fact that the UFO thesis has gone mainstream in 2020 is reflective of your efforts among those of others. You have helped open up our culture.
Well, thank you very much for saying that, Mitch. And let's all work together and open it up even more in 2021.
Knock wood. Knock wood.
This is a final reading from Jesus, A New Vision, which is available as a pre-order on Amazon, as a Kindle pre-order. It will be available as an audiobook, as a hardcover, and a softcover as soon as we can finish the process. I have discovered many things about Jesus simply by reading the Gospels and other materials with the eye of a detective. For example, it is clear that he intentionally goaded the Romans into killing him. In these pages, the reason that he did this will become clear. He was helped by a group of people who are almost invisible in the Gospels, but not quite. They were not members of any known order, such as the Essenes. Like him, these people knew many secrets, and those secrets have been lost for a long time. Using a combination of a re-examination of his teaching and modern scientific advances, we can recover them. Some of them are hidden in the Shroud of Turin, which was not a medieval forgery, as was incorrectly concluded back in 1988. As shall be seen, the evidence refuting that conclusion is overwhelming. Scientific tools available now can give us a very clear picture of what really happened in that tomb, information that can enable us to understand not only him, but ourselves in a very new way. This book is not only about a new vision of Jesus, but also a new vision of consciousness and its surprising effect on the natural world, and what that means to each of us and about each of us. Jesus is a great mystery, even more a mystery than we have believed. We shall, in this book, explore that mystery. Next up and last in this year-end special, Lee Spiegel with his truly extraordinary stories. Lee Spiegel is an old friend of Dreamland and an old friend of Whitley Strieber's as well. He was the go-to guy on the weird desk at the Huffington Post for many years. He has a long and colorful history just in general, and not only in terms of UFOs, but he's a great guy and an absolutely fascinating guy. And you can listen to him on his own podcast. Can you tell us a little bit about it, Lee?
It is called, and by the way, thank you, Whitley, for having me on.
Oh, sure.
The podcast that I do is called Edge of Reality Radio on KGRADB.com, and it's kind of a resurrected version of a show that I first did about 40 years ago on NBC Radio, which I called The Edge of Reality back then. And I did that show for 4 years, and now I'm back doing it as the without the it's now called Edge of Reality Radio. And happy to be back on the air and enjoying what I'm doing once again. It's like riding a bike, as they say. when you do something and, or haven't done it for a long time, and suddenly you're put in a situation where you want to do it again. And I deal with all kinds of things, all of the topics that cross the fields of the paranormal, UFOs, unexplained phenomena, science. And this is, of course, a lot of what you're into as well.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
I feel you and I are kindred spirits.
Well, you know, we go back a while, and you go back an even longer while, in the sense that you first emerged into this field, in public at least, during the 70s.
Yes.
During the UN conference on UFOs, which was a huge, really history-making, groundbreaking event, because it go ahead and tell us about it.
Well, prior to that, Whitley, I had done the very first thing I ever did in the whole field of UFOs was I'm sure you and I are old enough to know. Do you remember vinyl records by any chance?
Listen, I have a huge collection of vinyl records, and I have a Fisher tuner that I bought in 1963.
Oh, my.
That still works perfectly. It's never even needed a new tube. It weighs about 150 pounds,
yeah,
but it produces the most splendid music you could ever listen to. And, you know, and it's, I use it with vinyl. And, you know, the CDs are a pale comparison, and streaming, quite frankly, just doesn't cut it.
I know how you feel. But back in 1975, was the first thing I ever did, as I was saying, that I produced and wrote a vinyl documentary spoken word record album for CBS. And that was back in the days when CBS used to have these primetime television infomercials for Columbia House Records. If you order now, and there was like a 2-minute commercial, get the best of Mitch Miller and the gang.
Right, I remember those commercials.
Or the greatest hits of Mantovani. And if you order now, we'll also throw in a book or something else. And, you know, it was one of those things. If you don't like the recording, send it back, but keep the other gift. It was that kind of a thing. And I thought, boy, it would be amazing if I could put together and get enough contacts to help me get a deal with a major recording company and put a record out with the voices of people talking about UFOs, and not just public or private citizens, but military people, astronauts, politicians, law enforcement, scientists, and put them all together, write an interesting script, and put it out there. And what was nice about it is Columbia liked the idea and said, yeah, we'll sell it for you on TV. And they let me produce and write the TV 2-minute commercial for it. It was amazing.
That's wonderful. Why did you want to do this in the first place?
Because in 1973, I was in New York. I had come to New York in 1970 with a suitcase and my guitar. I was a folk singer from New Hampshire, and I came to New York looking for a recording contract of some sort, because I knew if I wanted to make a record, I had to come to New York. That was the place to do it. And for the first 3 years, I played a lot of different clubs around the city, and in October of 1973, something happened in this country that really caught my attention. Two different events involving UFOs happened within the same week in late October. And one of them involved two fishermen who were fishing on a pier in Pascagoula, Mississippi, Calvin Parker and Charlie Hickson. And news spread rapidly around the country of a story that they claimed they were abducted by something or someone into somewhere and had experiments done on them. I mean, it just took the country by storm, and within the period, like I say, of a week, a four-man army helicopter crew flying over Ohio, under the command of Captain Larry Coyne, they nearly collided with a cigar-shaped UFO that was coming at them really fast from the horizon. And this was something that was witnessed by many people on the ground. And as the lights got closer and closer to the helicopter, they braced for impact. All they could do was just wait and die. And yet the UFO suddenly stopped without colliding. It went above the helicopter. And at that point, they could see lights underneath it that reflected the cigar shape of it. No wings, no tail, no horizontal stabilizer, nothing that looked like a modern day aircraft, just a giant cigar hovering in the air above them. And it shined a green beam of light into the cockpit. It bathed all the electronics in the cockpit. Of course, they were frightened. They had no idea what they were encountering. And Captain Coyne tried to put the helicopter into a dive to get it closer to the ground. But instead, something grabbed onto the helicopter and pulled them up several thousand feet in a matter of seconds without them even knowing it, because they could see it on their dials. And it suddenly, there was a lurch and a bump, and it let them go. And the UFO shot off in one direction, and Captain Coyne went to the nearest airfield and radioed ahead and said to the Army, you better have some media there, because we're going to tell what just happened to us. And the Army let them do that. And it hit the news.
Yeah.
I first became aware of it shortly after, when Captain Coyne was a guest on the Dick Cavett Show. And I went, whoa, what is going on here? First, the Mississippi fishermen, that they were on TV, and now Captain Coyne. Why at this point in time is the media showing any interest in this stuff? And I'll tell you, Whitley, it was like that proverbial, like a light bulb that appeared over my head. And it basically said to me, Mr. Spiegel, you are about to change your priorities, and you are no longer going to be searching for a recording contract for your folk music. You're going to start looking into UFOs and extraterrestrials. And like, who was I to say no? I mean, really.
It's astonishing. What's astonishing about it are two things. First, that it happened so long ago, and nothing basically changed. We're still out there going, oh, maybe this is real. Maybe this, maybe that, maybe they're here. You know, we have Leslie Keene on this same edition of Dreamland, who's talking about basically struggling with the New York Times now. And yet you're telling a story that was, 40 years ago?
I know. And, I mean, I'm still astonished. I remember when I called my folks right after the moment that the light bulb went off in my head, and I called my folks back home in New Hampshire, and they said, well, son, what's going on with you? And I said, well, I hope you're both sitting, but I wanted to let you know I've decided to change my destiny here in New York. I'm no longer looking to promote my music career. I'm going to start looking into something called UFOs. And for the rest of the conversation, my mother got really quiet. But my dad, he was like, oh, and what do you mean UFOs? What do you mean extraterrestrials? Tell me more about that. And I thought, well, okay. not the response I was expecting, but that's a good thing. And literally, Whitley, I did the record album in 1975. 3 years later, when I found myself in the middle of putting together a presentation at the United Nations, my parents were so into that they packed up the car and my younger brother, and they drove to New York in a snowstorm from New Hampshire so that I could bring them to the United Nations so they could see this happening.
Yeah, it's just astonishing, and yet here we are. I just kind of don't get it, or don't want to believe that we are we're like sleepers in a dream that we can't wake up from. It's really frightening, because you and I are talking about things that, frankly, most of my listeners weren't born when they happened.
Oh, I know.
And these, I mean, you just described one of the most extraordinary UFO experiences or cases in history. And you know what? I didn't even remember it. Not until you opened your mouth. At the time, I probably knew about it, but in the early 70s, I was, could not be less interested in this subject. I mean, in fact, I would have probably scoffed at it. But,
well, because,
are we in some kind of a state of hypnosis, Lee? Is that what's happening to us?
Well, I don't know, but you're just talking about the dates. So these two cases that really got my attention happened 12 years before your first encounter.
Yeah, I know. That's what you just said. 12 years. It's mind-bending.
Well, and again, the thing that really I like to put the focus on, to me, it's like, let's keep it simple, folks. All this talk about all these new UFO things, the UFO tic-tac that the Navy filmed and videos that are coming out and that we've been seeing, and, oh, the big story on the front page of the New York Times 3 years ago. Fine. That's great. But you know what, folks? Let's go back to 1947, shall we? Because when I started researching and reading about UFOs in 1973, I couldn't get away from things like formerly classified military documents. Going back to 1947, one top secret memo written by a General Nathan Twining of the Air Materiel Command, and basically it was a memo from him to Joint Chiefs of Staff and higher ups of the military saying, this is our current concise suggestion of what these flying discs are about. And it begins by saying the phenomenon is something real and not fictitious and not a product of people's imaginations. And as you could probably guess, the phenomenon from that memo from 1947, that's how James Fox and I realized that should be the title of the documentary that is out there right now.
Yeah, which gets us to the phenomenon, which you were one of the producers on. You and I believe Mark Barish was involved.
Mark Barish, yeah.
A wonderful man and a dear old friend. But you were involved. And you worked, in fact, after you left the Huffington Post, you sort of dropped off the face of the earth for a couple of years because you were doing this.
Because I was doing this. Yeah. In fact, I think, I think the last time you and I saw each other was when you came to the Huff Post and you and I was, and I gave you the tour of the place.
Yeah, exactly, of the Huff Post.
And what was going on during this time was James Fox had already spent 4 years working on this documentary, The Phenomenon, and he was after me for a while to join his team, but I couldn't because it would have been a conflict of interest to become a writer on The Phenomenon while I was still a writer for HuffPost. And as fate sometimes will step in on something like that, Huffington Post merged with a couple of other companies. Arianna Huffington eventually left the Huffington Post. New leadership came in, and there was a massive layoff, and I was part of the layoff. And on the day that I was let go, I called James and said, is that invitation for me to join your team still around? He said, why? Did something happen? And I said, yeah, I just got laid off from the HuffPost. And he said, oh, I'm really sort of unhappy to hear that because, yeah, when can you start? And I said, how about today? And that's how that happened.
I remember those days very well. I was very worried about you.
Well, I appreciate that. I wasn't. Because
no, you weren't. I remember you were hardly worried about you at all. You figured you'd land on your feet.
Yeah, or I'd be taken away, as my friend Whitley Strieber knows about that. But I've thought many years over how you and I have both probably had so many people come to us and say, hey, how close are we to disclosure? When is this going to happen? Why hasn't it happened?
Why hasn't it happened?
Exactly. And I keep telling people, it has happened. But I'll say to people, have you personally gone out and looked into this subject yourself and taken some time out of your life and done some investigative reporting and even interviewed some interesting people about it? Have you done this in order to form a more valid opinion of the whole UFO thing? And most people will say, oh, no, haven't had a chance to do that. And I generally come back with, I'll say something like, well, in my opinion, you don't have a valid opinion until you put some time or effort.
Yeah, to think a little bit.
Yes.
Or actually do another incredible thing, which is read.
Oh, yes.
Because people
what a concept.
That people are so passive. I mean, they just sit and wait and wait and wait, and then they ascend into the beyond. That's that.
Every time I do a lecture or a presentation somewhere, and the audience comes in, they introduce me, and the very first thing that I say to the audience is, thank you all for coming today. Please, I'm going to ask you, don't believe anything I'm about to talk to you about over the next hour and a half. Just don't take my word for it. I'm just a messenger of information. Take the information that I'll give you, and then if you want more knowledge about it, then go out and look for it. But I'll provide you with some tools. And then you've got to go and make it worth your own while so that you have something legitimately intelligent to talk about tomorrow around the water cooler at your office.
Yeah. Well, the let me ask you, let me roll back to the album just briefly.
Sure.
It's not available anymore, is it? Or
It's about to make a reappearance.
Oh, good.
Actually,
Lee's website is leespiegel.com, and you can find his show on kgra.com.
Well, I you know what? And I'm glad you said that, because it's undergoing a little bit of an identity change, and it's still in the process of it. And there are things about that I'm not totally happy about. But just to be perfectly safe and sound and truthful, if people want to hear the show or anything that's on KGRA, they won't find it if right now, at this point in time, KGRARadio.com essentially is not where they're going to find it. If you want to find the show, you want to hear Whitley on KGRA, you have to go to KGRADB, which stands for digitalbroadcasting.com.
That's KGRADB.com.
DB.com. Oh, yeah. Because if you go to KGRARadio.com, you will hear tumbleweeds going through your house, because you won't find anything there except constant error messages as they go through their transition of redirecting people to find the actual station.
So
that's important for people to know, yeah.
Okay, well, I'm looking at KGRADB right now, and what do I find? I find, among other things, your show. So there we go.
Yeah.
Okay, great. All right, well, look, the phenomenon is out. And
it
supposedly other things will happen in this year, but what will change? What you just described, those Army officers talking about their experience.
Oh.
All those years ago, no one in the military would be allowed to talk about that now.
Of course. And can I give you an extra little piece of information about that?
Yeah, please.
For the United Nations presentation, I recruited to be my main speakers there, Dr. J. Allen Hynek, the former United States Air Force consultant and astronomer on UFOs.
Yeah, who needs no introduction on this show?
Right. Okay, and probably someone else who needs no introduction, astrophysicist Jacques Vallée was one of my speakers at the UN.
Yeah, I tried to get him to interview, but he's busy. He's working on a book, darn it. Go ahead.
Yeah. Gordon Cooper, one of the first astronauts.
Guy. Brilliant man. And another one I interviewed years ago before Dreamland before I owned Dreamland, so I don't have the interview anymore. But yeah, I knew him too.
One of my other speakers there was the late, great nuclear physicist Stanton Friedman.
Oh, wow.
I wanted him to be there. But there was one other person who I wanted to speak at the UN, and that was because he was on my album, my 1975 album, which was called UFOs, The Credibility Factor. I wanted Lieutenant Colonel Larry Coyne, the commander of that helicopter from 1973. I wanted him to come to the UN and tell his story to the nations of the world. And he said he would like to do that, but he said in order for that to happen, I would have to call his commanding officer in the Army back in Ohio and get permission. And I said, well, what do you think the chances are that they'll give me permission? He said, well, you know, things have changed a little bit. It's only been 5 years since the incident, but maybe they'll let me come. I don't know. So he gave me the commanding officer's phone number. I called him right away, got the guy on the phone, introduced myself, told him why I was calling, that I was hoping that they could give me permission to bring Colonel Coyne to the UN to tell his story about the near collision with the UFO. And his officer said, well, we would actually consider letting you do that. However, we would have only one condition. And I'm thinking, oh, great. Here it comes. How many of my children must I give up for this? What's the condition, sir? He said, we would not want Colonel Coyne to be at the United Nations in uniform. He has to be there dressed in civilian clothes. And I went, ah, really? So you're saying if I buy him a new suit, maybe more than one new suit, you'll let him come? He said, yeah, that's the only thing we ask. I said, wow, you got a deal. And they had a deal. And he was one of my speakers.
Well, that's great. And you see, you know, the Air Force is totally, totally clammed up about this. And my background is Air Force. With my uncle was Air Force and who was involved in the Roswell incident. I don't want to go into it. My listeners know the story. And so it's a sort of Air Force family. But if you notice, there in the whole trajectory of this, there are some things that the Army has said, very few things the Air Force has done except Project Blue Book, which is a travesty.
Right.
Not the text. The text is good. It's the introduction that's the travesty. That was the only thing the media cared about, too. They didn't care about the fact that there were a lot of cases that were unexplained, very powerful cases. All they cared about was the introduction where the Air Force said there was nothing to it.
You know, the original title for the documentary that later became The Phenomenon, the original title was The 701. And do you know what the 701 relates to? 701 cases that the Air Force couldn't explain in Project Blue Book.
My, that many.
Yeah. Yeah.
That
and
many.
So James thought in the beginning, 7 years ago, we'll call it the 701. What a great title. And then there were other people that came along and said, no, nobody's going to know what that means. You'll have to explain it. And I remember thinking, well, why not explain it? What's wrong with explaining it? I'm okay with that.
Yeah. The phenomenon is a good title because it's bigger than – it's not just flying saucers and apparent aliens. It's a much bigger picture than that.
Yeah.
Which gets me to a question for you.
Okay.
You're aware of the bigger picture, the Close Encounters of the Third Kind. You know my story very well. The relationship between the phenomenon and the dead, which has never been explored much outside of a few, very few places. My books, for example, are one.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about it beyond what you did in the move in the documentary, which is intended for a general audience to bring them along? But there's a bigger story there.
Of course.
Can you tell us what your vision of the bigger story is in about 40 seconds? No,
40,
I'm kidding.
40
we have about 5 minutes.
The vision that I've been working on personally is I think it's beyond just nuts and bolts craft from Alpha Centauri coming here to take people away or doing experiments. I think there's something more going on here than we have been told because there has to be something more. The stories have come out of people like yourself who, after having an experience like what you went through, suddenly things going on inside your mind have begun to open up. Experiences, visions, information that comes to you from a variety of sources, you're not the only person who's going through this. And I find that really fascinating that many people are coming out with similar experiences after they've had their initial experience with whatever this thing is. You and I like to refer to them as the visitors. I'm very comfortable with that.
Well, I've lived with them for 30 years. The last time I had an encounter with them was night before last. I just live with them. It's as simple as that.
And I remember you telling me when you and I were sitting in the kitchen of the Huffington Post, and I said to you, Whitley, do you suppose that your visitor friends are actually listening in on our conversation right now? And you said, well, it's possible. And then I asked you, so Whitley, what can we do what can you do to help arrange for me to meet one of your visitor friends? Because I would love to get an interview. And I remember what you said. I'll never forget it. You said, Lee, be careful what you wish for.
Well, it ain't easy.
I'll never forget that.
No, it ain't easy. And it's not like, I mean, you're not ever going to sit down across the table from one of them and have it and do an interview. I don't think, but they're so surprising and they've got so many different levels to this and they're so many different directions it comes from and goes in that I wouldn't say that's beyond the realm of possibility. I want to ask you, this. There's the phenomenon is an extraordinary documentary, and will there ever be anything on the close encounter experience, on my experience, for example?
Well, James and I have talked about this a lot, and he deliberately – look, as you know, we had 100 minutes to fill, to keep it to an hour and 40 minutes.
Yeah.
And there's so much more material that ended up on the cutting room floor. And he knows perfectly well that all the people who are going through the close encounter of the third, fourth, and fifth kind, people want to know, why aren't they doing a movie about us? And there are some productions that have come out.
But not very good for the most part.
Well, but they're not, I would say, not credible. And I'm not trying to pat myself.
No, that's right. Not credible. That's perfect.
So you've got to be credible. You've got to make sure that all of your T's are crossed and your I's are dotted. You don't want to open yourself up to any possible crazy stuff. Listen, skepticism is great. You want to debunk it, fine. But if you're going to debunk it, come at it with really good ammunition about what it is you're debunking here.
Well, because you know, if I went as far as I could with my book, A New World, in terms of what this experience is like, and I don't think I can go any farther because unless you are deep into it, and not many people ended up as deep as I am because I simply have been consciously attempting to work with them for 30 years and getting a response, which not everybody does. And it's so strange. It's beyond strange.
Well, I would like to see someone like you and someone like James Fox and other people who have gone through these experiences. And I've become aware, as you probably have too over the years, It's just not private citizens who are being taken out of their beds in the middle of the night and taken somewhere. It's people who are in the military or in the government who are having these experiences. And
well, Bob Bigelow said he'd had one on 60 Minutes, for goodness sakes.
Yes. And yet, I spoke with someone who used to be with the CIA who has said the same thing.
Yeah, so, well, even publicly, I know who you're talking about, but I'm not sure how publicly, so I'm not going to say his name either.
Right.
I'm scared to. He's a dear guy, though. I mean, I'll say that about him.
And why would someone like him, or like many other people, why would they just even start talking about this kind of stuff because of the ridicule factor that would come back at them? No, I think that they do it because they know that they went through something that was real, not fantasy or fiction. Or illusion, and they would like somehow for this to come out so that the public can be made more aware of this.
Yeah.
So I think that in my vision, I would love to see the Phenomenon Part 2 or Beyond the Phenomenon. Let's do another one.
If you want my help, I'm here.
Well, I think.
But you know, there's one thing I'd like to add. I tried to get the TTSA guys on Dreamland. And they talked together, the five of them, not Tom DeLonge, but the others, mm-hmm. and they decided they did not want to go on my show.
And why?
Because they did not want to be identified with this end of it at all.
Really?
Because of what they're trying to do. They felt like it might, just being on my show, might harm their credibility.
Really? That, you know what's so weird about that, Whitley? Did they think that it could hurt their credibility about what they're trying to do?
It's not that I'm not unfriendly with them. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
I think they're trying hard to do a very, very difficult thing. And if that's a concern of theirs, then I respect that. But I don't think they're right about it. I think their credibility is already sufficiently challenged by what they're doing.
I found out 30 years after the fact. The fact being 30 years after I produced the presentation at the United Nations. While I was at the Huffington Post, the United Kingdom was in the habit of releasing, public release of a lot of previously classified UFO documents from the UK. And a batch of documents came out, and my editor, Buck Wolf, asked me if I wanted to do a story about the new documents. And I said, sure. And I got copies of the documents, and I'm reading some of these documents 30 years after the presentation at the UN, and I'm finding myself reading a batch of materials stating how the UK in 1977, 78 was trying to stop the United Nations from allowing my presentation to come forward. Like, what? What am I reading now, 30 years later?
Amazing.
They actually tried to stop it, and the reasoning was the UK didn't think that the United Nations credibility would survive allowing a presentation on UFOs to take place. Like, you've got to be kidding me. I'm still speechless when I hear myself say that. Like, what is wrong with this picture, everybody? Who's in charge here is another question.
I think somebody is in charge, and I think that they are very skilled social scientists, and I think that's why we're going around in circles. I mean, 1975 to 2020, and where are we? We're just about where we were then.
Oh, yeah.
If you go back farther into the 50s, there were congressional hearings, NICAP, the National Institute for whatever it was called, NICAP.
National Institute. National Investigations Committee on Aerial
Phenomena. Chaired by a former director of the first director of the CIA, Admiral Hillenkoetter.
Yeah.
And we're still nowhere. We're still with the New York Times saying, well, wait a minute. This is too weird. We have to be careful. We have to be sure we're got all of our I's dotted and T's crossed. This isn't an accident. Somebody's doing this to us. I know these guys very well, the what I call the visitors at this point in my life. I mean, I wouldn't say I know them. I know them as well as anybody ever has, I would suspect. And anybody who's been in any way in the public space, anyway. But they are really clever. And I think they're making us spin our wheels. I think they're doing it to us.
And it raises a question. Last week on my show, and also last week on your site, on unknowncountry.com, you did a story, and I did a monologue on my show about what is up with this ex-Israeli space administrator or space minister saying that aliens are hiding until mankind is ready. And NBC did a piece on it, and other big media. Like, why is media even paying attention to this unless there's a reason for it? Because nobody seems to be ridiculing this story.
No, I mean, and he's got interesting credentials, and
yes,
he's trying to sell a book. So, you know, there's that. But in fact, I think it's true. I think that there is a higher level of suppression of this information. I just think that is my belief.
I agree with you, but then it brings another question. If that's true, And even if presidents of the United States, as Bill Clinton says in our documentary, that even presidents of the United States aren't always told things during their debriefings. They're not always given information about things like UFOs. If this is really true, who's pulling the strings or running the projector, and what could possibly be behind it that could cause panic or insecurities or people running to the Vatican and asking for God to save us? I mean, there's so many possibilities that I couldn't even begin to speculate, but I do believe that there is something out there, that the powers that be, whoever and wherever they are, they don't want us to have this information now. They don't think we're ready to join the Galactic Federation, quite honestly.
Well, I don't think there is a Galactic Federation. I have to say, I disagree with him on that.
Yeah.
Just viscerally. I mean, I don't know anything special, but it feels much more chaotic to me than that. But there is one consistent thing. It never will come into focus. And in the moments of focus that occur, they sort of seem like they kind of drop into a pond, and the ripple goes away, and then we go on down the road in another 20 years, another big moment of focus, and the same thing happens.
Right.
And we never get anywhere. We never get to any final position, place. But we have come to a final place, because I promised you 30 minutes, and this is for a big year-end show. But that said, I was on your show recently for a full show, and we had a hell of a good time. And I need to have you back here in the next few weeks, and we'll do hour and a half Dreamland together for two reasons. One is you're incredibly knowledgeable, and two is you do know something about how to tell a story.
I've been told I go on way too long. But
no, not on this show. You don't. We're here to listen to great stories. And
I want to thank you for having me on, and I want to wish you and Anne and all of your listeners and readers from Unknown Country and Dreamland, I want to wish you all, you know, a happy, safe, and healthy holiday season. And of course, I include Anne in that. And when we have more time to talk, I want to get into your relationship with Anne.
When you come back on the show, we'll do it.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Merry Christmas and Happy New Year, my friend.
Same to you. Thank you, Willie.
Bye-bye. And so we cross the year. We bring the show to an end for another year. Seems hard to believe it's been such a year, 2020. I can remember the end of 2019 thinking, what could 2020 bring? And it has brought much more than any of us ever expected. Back in March, the visitor said to me that the situation we were in, meaning the pandemic, would not begin to resolve itself until December. And indeed, that happened. In December, the vaccine started to be distributed. And the vaccine is the beginning of the end of the pandemic, hopefully. But they also added, your world will be forever changed. And I think that's something that we both have to look forward to and to be very aware of, because change means having to adapt. 2020 was a hard year, but perhaps we'll do better in 2021. What I would like to go out with is what I have been going out with every year for now quite a while, which is the Dreamland and Unknown Country Singers, which consisted of Anne and a number of other members of our clan singing Auld Lang Syne together at the end of a dreamland many, many years ago. You will hear her voice in this and the voices of others. Many of them, I have to admit, I do not remember exactly who they were. Some of them I still know. Some of them are still with the show and the website. But here they are. The Dreamland and UnknownCountry.com choir singing Auld Lang Syne. Goodbye, 2020. Hello, 2021.
Should old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? Should old acquaintance be forgot and days of old.